Mr. Chairman, let me begin by saying that it's not very often that you get a bill in front of your committee where young people are asking to stay in school longer. So this is kind of a unique bill in that regard. I've heard from high school students in my district that would be affected by this, as well as people all over the state. The idea of the bill is to remove the age limit of 21 years for the length of time that a child can be in high school and raise it to 23 years of age. Now, just let me say that it's not my intent to be opening this up so that we have a huge number of special education disabled children just staying in school longer because the law allows them to stay in longer. Really, the intent of this is to help people be able to graduate from high school who otherwise would not be able to. So this affects really two groups of kids. One, a child who might have dropped out of school and then realizes the folly of their ways and wants to come back to school and needs more time in order to finish up and graduate. And number two, students who are immigrants here, new arrivals here, who, because they haven't had the extensive educational background that's needed, they don't speak English, etc., when they come to the United States, need longer in order to be able to complete the coursework in order to graduate. And so that's what this bill is here to try to address. And in the interest of time, and also because I'm not feeling very well, I'll call on the people that came today to testify. And we can start with Carol Dolman.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Carol Dolman. I'm a teacher at Wellstone International in Minneapolis, and I brought with me three hardworking students from Wellstone. And they are here to tell you that they have an urgent need to graduate from high school as soon as possible so that they can go on to college to support their families and help their younger brothers and sisters in education also. They know that to reach their goals, they need to complete their education. The problem is that at age 21, there's no appropriate program for them. They're too old to stay in high school, so we can't keep them. The adult programs were designed for even older adults who are working, and so those programs are part-time. And these students want full-time school. In fact, they want more than full-time school. They go to summer school. They go to after-school classes. And even GED is not a good fit because it requires a higher reading level, and because they are such recent immigrants, they don't have that reading level when they start. They would have it by the time they graduate, but they may not be there yet. If Sita, at the end, has to go to, if she could stay at Wellstone next year, she could finish in a year. If she goes to adult ed, it'll take her two. Kali Fala could finish in two. At Wellstone, it'll take him 4 years to finish high school if he needs to go to adult ed. There are not enough of these students, even in Minneapolis public schools, to start a new adult ed program for them. We're talking about maybe 30 to 40 students a year. And they don't really need a new program. They just need to be allowed to finish what they started and complete where they're already successful. The consequences of the 21-year-old age limit that we have now are that some students see that limit. They know they can't graduate, and they drop out early. Other students stay as long as they can, and we try to transition them to adult ed, but they don't stay with it. They're not making the same progress, and they disappear. And there are also students that disappear, come back and visit, and say that they are working in low-skill, low-wage jobs, even though they had been successful students earlier. And this bill will help students stay in school. It will help them finish high school quicker and go on to college, support their families, mentor their younger brothers and sisters, and pave the way for them when they go on to college, help them support their parents as soon as possible, and in time support their own children, because these are the students who are going to be responsible for three generations, and they're eager to start. And I will leave an article with Senator Berglund from the Star Tribune a week ago Saturday, about poverty rates among this population. Deep poverty rates are going up across the country. They are going up faster in Minnesota, as you probably know, than any other state, and it is because of increases among recent immigrants. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dahlman.
We could have Asha Muhammad speak next.
This is Asha Khalifala.
Okay. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Asha Muhammad. I'm one of the students at Wellstone High School. I came to the United States late in 2005. I had an school in Africa, but I started and left while I was in the school. And English is my third language, and whenever I get here, I started going back to school and build my English skills up. And I'm in this school now. I build my English skills more than I do before. And there's some other friends of mine or other students in this school that had the same problem with me. I can't wait to go to my school and finish it and help my parents and be a good citizen of United States. But the problem is now the students can stay in this school beyond the age of 21 because of the law. And I have some students or my friends that left the school while they were 21. They can't go to adult ed, which is not a good fit for them, and now they are in the streets or they went for some low jobs that they can help with their parents, their problem, their brothers and sisters and all this. So as Asha, I work hard and I try my best to convince my fellow students to stay in this school. Even though they can go to their high school, they can go to adult ed. But it didn't work for me because everything is started from the mind, and the students don't have no more influential for them to go to adult ed because it's not good fit for them, and they can, you know, they are not in that kind of reading level. And, you know, the students had a dream that they want to be a doctor, they want to be leaders one day. And when they go to adult ed, the only choice that they have is just English and math. So we don't have social study, we don't have science class in there. So that's why we lost all our future by staying out. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next, I'd like to call on Khalifala.
The records show that a quorum's present. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Khalifala Dukuli. I'm from Liberia. And because of war there, I never built school. But my family moved to Guinea. It's another country in West Africa. And I went to school there, but in French. So I was in 12th grade when I moved to United States in September 2005. And I went to French school. I moved to United States. I have to start again in English. You know, it's too hard because when I was in Africa, I speak only French and Mandingo, my native language. So, and I moved here. It's very hard for me to speak English. And then I went to high school in Virginia. And then they put me in ninth grade. They say, in the United States, if you start, you have to start in ninth grade because your English too low, so you have to start there. And I say, okay, I was 19 this time. But now I moved to Minnesota. I'm here. I started in Wilson International High School. But last time they called me, Khalifala, we will not be able to stay in Wilson International High School next year because you will be 21. and then you have to move, you have to go to the basic adult high school. And then so I think my English is too low. I have to stay in high school with some friend who speak good English, and then with them, I can perform my English, and then if I have changed, I can go to college and then support myself, support my family, and then maybe one day do something for my country, because my country, they have war there, and then I think we need people who are intellectual, people who have experience to do something better for the country. So that's why last time I wrote a letter to my district representative, and I asked her explain her my problem, and then today I came here to testify, you know, in order to ask you to help us to solve this problem, because I need really to be in high school and then finish my high school, graduate, and go to college. Because everybody know if you want to be a good person tomorrow, you have to have good education. And I think if you want to have good education, you have to be in high school with good teachers, with students who want to be some, you know, students who speak good English, you know, they can help you to perform your English and do something good for the future, for your family and for yourself. Okay, for your country or for the place where you're supposed to live.
Thank you for sharing your testimony.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, this is kind of a little civics lesson for the students in this school, because the students wrote to me and asked me if I would introduce a bill to change the law. So they're learning how we do things in this country to improve people's lives by petitioning the government. So any consideration you can give to this bill, we certainly would appreciate it.
Thank you. And Senator Berglund, would the other person at the table like to at least do an introduction for the record?
My name is Sita Mao. I'm from Cambodia.
Welcome to the committee. And the students, you can see how the democracy works, and Senator Berglund responded with a bill. And we are impressed with the need that's been documented, but we will need to send this to our finance committee as well for further review. Before we vote, I'd like to ask, is there anyone in the audience that would like to address the committee on Senate File 989? If not, Senator Rummel moves that Senate File 989 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. Further discussion? All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you
Senator
much.
Berglund, and the students and staff from Wellstone. Next, Senator Saltzman, Senate File 1190. The last item on the agenda, Board of School Administrators Rulemaking Authority. I had asked a couple of the reps on that bill to please talk to Roger Aronson about some issues, and to the extent you can do that, that would be appreciated. As Senator Saltzman's witnesses, testifiers approach, we do have a background information provided in a memo from Shelby McQuay. And, of course, for those of you on the site visits, we learned a great deal about the program at St. Croix and the need for this. So we'll keep that in mind as well, as this does need to go to the Finance Committee.
Senator Saltzman. I would like to introduce a delete all amendment, and then the A1 amendment, which is being passed out.
Okay, Senator Saltzman moves the A1 amendment, author's amendment. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Prevails. Senator Saltzman.
And Mr. Chair, thank you very much. The delete all amendment has just a few changes in terms of terminology, and it just tightens up the bill a little bit. You know, for those of you who were at the special education hearing that was held in the E-12 committee last week, we heard a lot of testimony about special education and the need for funding. But the piece that we also need to consider is the reform and how do we intervene earlier with our youngest learners to reduce the need for special education programs and ultimately reduce the costs, but also to improve student achievement. We talk a lot about that children first learn to read and then they read to learn. And this is a program that I am so excited about because it has been sort of a pilot project in Minnesota for about 10 years. And so we have wonderful data that shows that it works. And I believe that we should target investments into those areas that we know really improve student achievement. And that's what this particular program does. It also talks a lot about response to intervention, or RTI, which is sort of a new thing. In the past, in terms of special education, what has happened is there's been the wait-to-fail model, in that we wait for children to fall behind before we can intervene. And this program is saying, why wait 2 years? Let's identify kids as they start to have problems and intervene in a very non-invasive way. I have four people with me today who I am so excited to have talk to you about this. And I think they can go over this bill in much more detail than I can. I have Chris McHugh, who is the director of the St. Croix River Education District. Also from SCRED is Dr. Kim Givens. And then Mary Rubrick is with the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education. And then we also have Robert Wadle, who is with Education Evolving. But, you know, for many of us, we have seen him here as the Commissioner of Education under Governor Carlson. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's for those of us who have been here around a long time. So at this time, if Dr. McHugh could start, that and I believe you also have some handouts as well. Actually, we're going to have Robert Wadle begin the presentation.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. It's good to be with you today to talk about a very, very exciting new initiative for Minnesota. My comments are going to be very brief, but for the record, I am Bob Wadle. I'm a former commissioner of education, and right now I work with a policy group called Education Evolving. Just a few comments in terms of a policy nature. First of all, this bill brings all of the educators at our sites together, whether they be classroom teachers, Title I teachers, LD special ed teachers, volunteers, et cetera. It really brings them together to focus on the individual needs of students. And it does this like nothing you have ever seen before. And I think that's a safe assumption to make. It's not that folks aren't working together now, but what this really does is brings them together around student performance information. And then puts into place interventions for our students. So that's one thing. It brings the people together like nothing we've had before. Second, and this is kind of startling, it creates the kind of testing that teachers want. Now, I'm sure that most of the time people say there's an overburden, we've got way too much testing. That may be true, but not the right kind of testing. This testing is what teachers want because it provides them information that they can use immediately in their classrooms, working with individual children, to improve how they are teaching. So this is the kind of testing teachers want. Third, it really reduces the ultimate referrals for special education evaluation. And that's really a crucial component because as we're looking at the high cost of special education, one way to really reduce that cost is to have children not need it to begin with. And with this kind of a model, the data will show that really is the result. Fewer kids are actually needing that kind of intensive services. So it certainly is a way to reduce the costs rather than try to increase revenue to continue to do things the same way as we always have been. So this is a different way of doing things. Fourth, this model really is recognized by the feds in the new Individuals for Disabilities Education Act. So you don't have to worry about, is this going to get us into trouble with the feds? The answer is no. As a matter of fact, in the federal regulations, this model is encouraged. The bill also talks about assistance to school districts in Minnesota from other school districts. And I think this is an important policy, Mr. Chair and members, because what it recognizes is that expertise is really in our local school districts. And to have those that are doing things really in an expert fashion, they should be the ones that are working with other sites around the state. And then, oh yes, Mr. Chairman, one last thing. Children learning actually improves very substantially with this kind of policy. So with that in mind, Mr. Chair and members, thank you for taking these comments prior to the presentation by Chris McHugh.
Thank you. And as I mentioned earlier, we have had testimony and a site visit already on the St. Croix program. And so if we could highlight, we'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks also for the committee coming to North Branch and taking a detailed look at our program. I just remind you about one of the couple of the graphs that we showed you about our student progress, and this is just a program that actually increased reading achievement for all students, as shown on the graph on the bottom of page 5. It especially increased the reading achievement of the bottom 10% of students, and that's shown on the page 7. And then the one that I think is sort of very interesting from a statewide policy perspective is on page 8, and there you see the significant reduction that the St. Croix River Education District schools have seen in the last 10 years in our incidence of learning disabilities, where we've the number of students that we've identified has decreased from close to 4.5% to just about 2.5%, so about a 50% reduction, remembering that as we reduced, it wasn't a reduction in services because more kids received services and increased. And I thought what would be interesting today is just to assure you that this is something well received by teachers. And my colleague, Dr. Kim Gibbons, who's our Director of Special Education, will show you a few of the individual graphs that that give sort of the heart of the system. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and other members of the committee. I am going to take just a few moments and share with you some individual student graphs from around our education district. These are all students that are regular education students that have been below academic achievement standards that have been set by the district and have achieved success using regular education interventions with the model that Mr. McHugh described. I believe you have a packet of graphs in front of you. I'll just take a minute to familiarize you with the graph, and I'm going to be starting with the one that's labeled Grade 4 Reading Standard Progress Monitoring Passages. It should be the first graph in your packet. This graph shows along the y-axis the number of words read correctly in 1 minute, which is a recognized standard of measuring overall reading achievement. Along the y-axis, you'll see weeks throughout the school year, so this graph is representing one school year. This particular student, who I'll refer to as Billy, is a fourth grade student who in the beginning of the school year in the fall was reading 80 words correct per minute. Now this was just a few points below the target score that was set, so the team determined with this student that they were going to monitor his progress regularly and they would come in with supplemental interventions if his progress was insufficient. So you'll see that there's the first data point is at 80 words read correct per minute, and then there's a line that's been drawn across the remainder of the graph that ends at around 112 words a minute. That's called the goal line. That's where the team wanted the student to be at the end of the year. And this is an example of a student who did not require any additional intervention because had a good trajectory of progress. The second graph in your packet is a second grade student that I'll refer to as Jenny. This was one of the lowest performing readers and made overall low growth in first grade. The school district paid for supplemental tutoring in between first and second grade using some funds that were generated from the Target credit card program. She began her second grade school year 18 points below target and participated in a number of interventions throughout the year. So every time you see a vertical line drawn on the graph, like you'll see Super Booster, that's the name of an intervention program. So every time you see a vertical line, that means that the school intervened with some type of powerful intervention for the student. And you can see over the course of the school year that there were many interventions that were put into place and that the student made good progress. The third intervention line you'll see says DI. That was the team determined to put the student in a different curriculum, and she made progress, so they took her out of that curriculum and put her back into the core curriculum that all students were using and continued to make good progress with some additional supports in place. The third graph in your packet is again another second grade student, a boy this time that I'll refer to as Johnny. This student began the year 27 points below the fall target. He was added to a supplemental skills instruction group to practice skills. In October, the team decided to use additional intervention time to boost up his rate of progress, as you can see by the repeated reading. Also added an AmeriCorps worker that was assigned to the building to do supplemental intervention. And this, again, is another example of a student that, with some good supplemental interventions in place, made good progress. And I should point out that both of these students, in our old way of doing things, would have been students that would have gone on to possibly for a special education evaluation. The last graph in your packet is a rather powerful graph that we share often with parents. This shows a student over 6 years in our school district, and you can see each little triangle is a student's data point in relationship to the rest of the distribution in that child's grade. So in the first grade of the student's career, he was well below average in relationship to the rest of the students in his grade level. And you can see by sixth grade is actually in the above average range. So this is a nice tool to show to parents to show how their students, we can track their progress over many grade levels in the school district.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Ruprecht, and I'm the Director of Special Education for the Rum River Special Ed Co-op, but I'm here today representing the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, MACE, as their president. And I'm here to support Senate File 1190, the Early Intervention Bill. I think that you're well aware of the rising cost of special education and how that continues to grow. And the directors of special ed are also very concerned about that. We need more programs that provide early intervention services for students, which allows us to assess and intervene and remediate when the problems are smaller rather than waiting until the problems become insurmountable. The wait-to-fail model that we presently use to identify students with learning disabilities is really not responsible. In fact, I would say that the sooner that we intervene, the more likely it is that we will actually be able to remediate because of the other problems that also appear, such as fear of failure. We need to intervene early, and we need to use a problem-solving model such as that's proposed in this bill, which would allow us to identify research-based and appropriate interventions for the student early in the student's educational career. The proposed bill provides funding to establish centers in the area of reading, math, and behavior supports in order to provide training to districts throughout the state in these research-based practices. Data from the SCRED districts absolutely supports that they are able to impact student achievement. It is our belief and the belief of the MACE members that early intervention programs such as Response to Intervention and school-wide positive behavior interventions and supports, also called PBIS, will have an effect of decreasing the number of students both in the areas of learning disabilities and also EBD, or emotional behavioral disabilities. These kinds of programs are a major paradigm shift for schools and require extensive training and support. this bill provides that training and support that's needed in order for schools to reform and do this kind of thing. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I might just add, one thing that I think is important to note about this program is that it doesn't identify children with IEPs. It really identifies them sort of on paper with non-invasive intervention. And so a child is not labeled as failing. They are seen as part of their whole classroom. And I think that that's a concern that sometimes with these early interventions that we start to label kids. One of the things I saw when I went with Senator Olsen up to SCRED and we sat in on a session and watched the teachers work with these kids in these graphs is that, you know, on several occasions we saw, you know, great growth with a child. And a teacher asked, well, what happened that week? And somebody said, well, we called the parents. We talked to the parents. We had a conference with parents. And so it's a really great way to show parents something that's very tangible about where their child is at instead of, well, your child's behind, they're a slow reader. They can really look at what can we do within our school, what can we do at home to help my child? Because children learn at all different rates. So thank you so much for this opportunity to present this.
Thank you. We also have Dr. Ephraim like to give us a statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm a mother of three, a pediatrician, and a policy analyst for EdWatch. And I want to say that EdWatch truly supports the overall intention of this bill, especially on the in the areas of reading and math, because as I testified a few weeks ago, 90% of the problems in special education are high incidence disorders, and 90% of those are related to reading problems. So to the extent that intervention can be done early, we truly very much support that, especially in reading. And I want to commend Senator Saltzman for bringing forth this bill. I just want to bring up cautions, and I'm not trying to undercut, and I apologize for not being able to get to you beforehand, but the concerns that we have are about the behavioral part of this, related to how that's assessed, what kind of data is collected, how and what kind of consent is done for the parents to do this kind of assessment and this kind of intervention. Because as you all are aware, state and federal law does require informed consent before the all special ed issues are assessed, and particularly in the emotional behavioral disability area where there is not agreement among experts, that just has to be really carefully handled. That's true from the President's Commission on Special Education. It is true for the American Psychological Association, which did a very big report on comparing medication and psychosocial interventions. And it is true for the fact that if you actually intervene on the academic areas first, many of the behavioral problems will often go away. There was actually a case of a pediatrician in the Chicago area who put all of the children that were referred to him for ADHD kind of problems into an intensive systematic phonics program, and not only did they improve scholastically, but their ADHD diagnosis and symptoms went away. So we just want to caution on the behavioral assessment and intervention to have that more clearly delineated on the types of things that are done, on the data collection, and on the consent, And then the other thing that we would bring up is that the, while we appreciate research-based, particularly in reading, the research seems overwhelmingly to point to intensive systematic phonics as the way to intervene, and we feel that that should be clearly stated in the bill.
Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to address the committee? If Senator Saltzman will, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, yes, I think, you know, I share your concerns and thank you for the support on those first two pieces. But if Mary Rupert could maybe just comment briefly on what the behavioral piece is, very, very briefly, I just want to be able to address those concerns and the direction that this bill would go with that.
I think it's really important for people to understand that the school-wide positive behavior interventions and supports is a system that establishes a different way to treat behavior problems in general in schools. For instance, right now, people really don't understand that when kids come to school and they don't know how to read or they don't know how to do their math problems, we recognize that it's our responsibility to teach them how to read and how to do math problems. But when kids come to school and they aren't behaving, we punish them. The school-wide system of positive behavior interventions and supports is a system of teaching behavioral expectations school-wide. So you teach the kids how to behave in the cafeteria, how to behave in my classroom, how to behave in the hallways. So it's a system of teaching is what it is, and positively reinforcing students for behaving through all kinds of special tickets and praise and some other things that really help to get at 85% of the problems in the school. When you get to the second tier, which might be some groups that might be teaching some social skills or some friendship groups, we do get parent permission and we do those kinds of things already. This helps us to identify and make that pool smaller. And the students that get into the highest tier are generally the students that we would assess for special education. The other thing that I would mention is we have a kind of a dual criteria in Minnesota. We have students can qualify with behavior problems or an emotional disturbance. They're not always the same. And that PBIS really works much better for kids with behavior problems. So, and at any time in this bill, it also suggests if a child needs to be referred for special education services, a parent can request that.
Thank you very much. Anyone else in the audience that would like to testify before the committee? Well, thank you, Senator Saltzman. As we indicated earlier, we've had field testimony on this as well and a hearing in Senator Stump's committee about the importance of early identification and aggressive intervention. Special education. Senator Rummel and others are working on that. So policy-wise, I see it in the direction we're headed, and now we just need to fill in the blank in Senator Stump's committee for the amount and your commitment to work with others that are interested. So Senator Saltzman moves that Senate File 1190, as amended, be recommended to pass and forwarded to the Finance Committee. Further discussion? Not all in favor, indicate aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Saltzman and witnesses. A couple of the authors we've asked if your witnesses are here, and Senator Torres-Ray, is your witness here yet?
Not here yet.
And Senator Carlson, are you ready? Pardon me? We'll take one. We have three bills addressing counselors, and we're going to take those in a cluster. We will get to the department bill eventually, but they're here each day, and for those witnesses that are here from beyond the metro, we want to do our best to accommodate you. So, Senator Carlson. Which one are we taking, Senator Carlson?
Mr. Chair, 752.
Okay.
Eliminating certain reserve requirements.
Okay, Senate File 752. Please proceed.
Chair and committee, we have a bill here to eliminate some of the either duplicate or unnecessary reserve requirements that need to be reported to the Department of Education. And I have two testifiers here, Mr. Stan Mack, from the superintendent from Robbinsdale Schools, and also Mr. Chuck Hergarten, the director of business services from West Tonka Schools.
Thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Senator Carlson, thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon to testify in support of Senate File 752. To reintroduce myself, my name is Chuck Hertigan, Director of Business Services for the West Tonka Schools. And again, I thank the committee for the opportunity to come out last week and visit us out in the greater part of the metro area. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, MASBO, and part of MASBO's platform this year contained a proposal that addressed mandate reduction and simplification of the ed finance formulas in the system, and many of those provisions you see in this bill. What I'd like to do now is take an opportunity to give you a background on some of the provisions that are in this bill and some of the rationale why we are proposing the changes. This bill contains provisions that would amend current statutes as they apply to school district operations and procedures for calculating and maintaining certain reserve accounts, preparing and disseminating of certain reports, submitting data to the Minnesota Department of Education through their electronic reporting systems, and conducting primary school elections in school districts. As we all know, a school district finances have required reductions in programs throughout the years here as budgets have been tight on the state and district level. The business services offices, the district offices, has also experienced some of those reductions in staff, as have the classrooms. Therefore, the preparation of some of these reports and conducting primary elections and the calculating the reserves continue to be a burden on the staff that is left after reductions and restructuring has happened. Just to go through some of the categories within this bill, there are certain reserve requirements contained in statutes that our complex categorical formulas of the past required us to calculate a reserve that was left at the year end based on revenues received. Maintaining these reserves now adds complexity to school accounting and sometimes actually causes confusion for members of the public as we try to explain the different pots of money we hold as a district. In many cases, maintenance of these reserves is valid and necessary, but others of the reserves has outlived their usefulness. The following reserve accounts have no current dedicated revenue streams, and we are recommending they should be abolished. Currently, there is a requirement to reserve dollars for class size, all-day kindergarten, and special education, a reserve for parental involvement programs, reserves for graduation standards, reserve for transportation safety, reserve for bus purchases, and reserve for certain teacher programs. And as I mentioned, due to financial limitations at the state level, the revenue streams for each of these reserves has been eliminated in previous years, and therefore maintaining these reserves is no longer relevant. Yeah. In addition to these reserves, there are other reserve requirements that are just as cumbersome to track and maintain, but they are still required, and we still do maintain those calculations. The bill also clarifies that school districts who are members of an area learning center, an ALC, must transfer revenue for students, no longer reserve, but must actually transfer the revenue to that ALC program, and also that a school district that is a member of an intermediate district or an education district would also be required to spend funds dedicated for cooperative programs operated by these agreements. And again, not reserve the funds, but would be required to spend those funds. This committee later will hear the Department's Education Policy Bill, and that bill also contains language that provides for the transfer of funds remaining in any of these reserve accounts. And I recommend the committees entertain that language also as we look to collapse some of these reserves. Another section of the bill deals with the elimination of certain reports that we are required to produce as school districts. As school business officials, MASBO encourages you as legislators to strive to eliminate reports that are of little value and recommend the department work to streamline the reporting procedures whenever possible. These reporting requirements require staff time at the district level and at the department to prepare reports and to review them. Certain reports we propose to eliminate would be the publication of financial information. Currently, there's a requirement that school districts would publish in a newspaper of local circulation their annual budget information, including audited data from the previous fiscal year. This requirement seems to be antiquated and redundant. Districts are required to provide their budget information at their truth and taxation hearings each fall, and then actual revenue and expense information is available on the report cards, which are published by the department. Most school districts also publish their budget and audited expenses and revenue information on their websites. As the accurate information becomes available, then that information is updated more so than just the one-time publication. This bill also clarifies the district requirement to notify the public of relevant public budget information, including the option to publish this data. And again, the districts would still have that option if they chose to publish it in their paper, but it would eliminate the requirement for publishing that data. The following reports are of little value, and this bill would propose that they should be discontinued. First of all is a superintendent's report on projected expenditures and student passage rates. Initially designed to provide information on the level of funding necessary to reach a high level of students passing the basic standards test, this report is based on subjective estimates made in each district with no consistency between districts. No apparent use is made of the reports as they're prepared. There's no evidence the reports are even being read. Also, as the VST tests continue to be phased out, we no longer have an eighth grade requirement. We do have a requirement in the upper level grades. Eventually, this report will become obsolete. Second report we would propose to eliminate is a notice to principals of general education revenue generated by pupils attending the school sites. Again, the information contained in this report is burdensome to calculate. There's no evidence the information has been used by anyone for any real purpose. Third report that we would propose to be eliminated would be a structural balance report. Again, this report, when implemented, was intended to provide information to the public about the impact of salary negotiations, the impact they would have on school district budgets. These reports are time-consuming to produce, as we must produce one for every agreement we have at each collective bargaining unit, but we see that these reports are of little or no value. Each report is very subjective, based on assumptions about inflation, retirements, and funding by the state in future years. Each school district makes its own set of assumptions, and the reports, therefore, are not comparable between districts. With the uncertainty of future funding formulas, school districts are not able to predict or control their revenues out into the future. Additionally, these reports are not tied in any way to long-range planning of the school district. As an example, in the Westonka School District, as part of our budget reductions 2 years ago, we had to reduce the position of Human Resources Director. The responsibilities of that position then fell to myself, the superintendent of schools, to implement. I now serve as the chief negotiator for each of our bargaining groups, so in addition to doing the negotiating, the language changes, I also do the financial projections of financial accounting for all that package, and it's, quite frankly, when it comes time for the structural balance report, it's not the highest of priorities to get completed as you're going through that process. Another area of the bill addresses the data reporting systems currently in place used by the department. There are five major electronic systems the department uses to collect data from school districts. UFARS, or the Uniform Financial Accounting Reporting System, which collects financial information on revenues and expenditures. The EDRS, or Education Data Reporting System, which collects salary and pupil projection data. STARS, or Staff Automated Reporting System, which collects data on licensed and unlicensed staff. MARS, the Minnesota Automated Reporting Student System, which collects enrollment and demographic data. And the newest reporting system is EMAP, the Electronic Minnesota Accountability Plan, which collects data for No Child Left Behind process. There's definitely an overlap among these systems, particularly between UFARS, EDRS, STARS, and EMAP. An example would be district staff is required to report expenditure data for No Child Left Behind program in the EMAP system, where we budget estimates by employee name. In the EDRS system, where we budget estimates and actual expenses, again, by employee name. In the UFARS accounting system, where we report actual expenses for the programs. And then in the STAR system, where we also report the staff licensure assignment. Another area of the bill that we are addressing is primary elections. We are requesting a change in statute to provide those to be discretionary rather than required. This was new legislative action 2006, which required school districts to hold a primary election if there were more than two candidates for each position or more than twice as many school board candidates as there were at large positions available in the district. This process is not only time-consuming for districts, but there is also a financial burden for this to happen. In the case, again, of West Tonka District, the cost to hold a primary election to reduce the number of candidates would be about $4,000. I've seen in a report West St. Paul, Mendota Heights District reported a cost of about $25,000 to hold a primary election. Again, as staff is reduced in schools, the availability of time, effort to produce a primary election becomes a burden, not only in terms of personnel time, but also financially. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I neglected to mention that I do have an oral amendment to the bill to get it into a shape that we need it in.
Okay.
And what it does is it moves some words from line 2.4 to line 2.8. The words cooperative services for should be inserted between the word on and special. So it says on cooperative services for special education and secondary vocational services.
On that oral amendment, all in favor indicate aye, and this is at line 2.4. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, prevails.
Thank you.
And members, as we said earlier, we on this particular bill, we've had testimony in an earlier special meeting where we talked about various mandates and reports, and many of these things are already reflected. So we have had 2 hours of discussion on a number of these things. You mentioned the bill on special elections, primaries, and I'm carrying that bill, actually. And that's been heard in Senator Larson's subcommittee already. So there's maybe dual tracks on some of the legislation. I know Senator Stump has an amendment, but Superintendent Mack, very briefly, if you'd...
Chair Wigger and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of AMSD and the Robbinsdale Area Schools. I will just point out a couple of highlights.
Please state your name for the record.
Stan Mack, Superintendent of Schools, Robbinsdale Area Schools. I would just like to briefly comment on a couple of issues, putting some facts to figures. During my now 35-plus, 36-year career in education, of which 31 have been in school administration, about 12 of those years I've been the chief negotiator for school districts in labor contracts. About three-fourths of those years, the requirement for structural report, balance reporting was in effect, and frankly, during all of that time, I have had no member of the public ever request the information, even though we conscientiously generated, and for all the unpredictables of the future that my colleague from Mount Westonka indicated, it is probably not worth the paper it's printed on. And frankly, elimination is a very positive thing. The other point that I would like to make, and of the 3 points, just commentary on primary election. In September 2005, the first and only primary election we've had to hold in the Robbinsdale District for school board elections, we ended up with basically doubling our cost of conducting elections. We are all are parts of seven cities in the northwest suburbs of Minneapolis. We had about, in that point in time, 62,500 registered voters. In that primary election in September of 2005, 1,290 people voted to eliminate one candidate from the pool. That is a cost of $24.80 per vote. In the general election of that year, some 5,381 people voted, bringing at least the cost down to $5.60 per vote.
Superintendent Mack, we're convinced that's an item to be changed, and Senator Larson's subcommittee has recommended approval. If you could please wrap up.
Chair Wigger, the one last item that I would encourage, all of the mandated reporting that require publication at additional cost, I would encourage looking at the existence of new media we publish and we provide on a constant basis, updated, revised, and proposed versions of our school budget on our district website. And there is no one in the public who desires information on a school district's budget that cannot get instantaneous access and not have to wait for the publication of a weekly newspaper. With that, I conclude my comments and be available for additional questions.
Thank you. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, nice to see you, Dr. Mack. I represent the school district, Dr. Maxson. With regard to the structural balance report, having lived through Hopkins School District's inadvertent slide into SOD, is there ever a case where compiling the structural balance report would actually alert a school district who might not have noticed it that they were going to be in SOD?
Senator Wieger, Senator Bonhoff, in response to that, there are plenty of other reporting devices available that would more accurately predict the issue of statutory operating debt indicators far ahead of structural balance, and far more reliable devices available.
Thank you.
Senator Stumpf has the A1 amendment, which has been distributed.
And Mr. Chairman and members, I think it would be easier to and Senate Counsel maybe can help here, to take lines 1.1 and 1.2 and then, the amendment works the way it does, but it would just be easier, I think, to take those two and then also delete lines 3.1 to 3.25. I think that accomplishes the same thing.
What's this? Senate Counsel, would you like to speak to that?
Ms. Butler? Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand the second part.
What I'd like to do is delete subdivision 1, 2, and 3, and 4.
Oh. Huh?
Of section 3.
Of section 3.
So the first two lines of the amendment.
Dealing with the publication of financial information section 3.
Well, yeah, the first two lines, line 1.2 on page 2 says the board must include the information. And then on 2.32, you delete the or and add and. So at a Department of Education's website and publish the information in a qualified newspaper. And then the rest of it, subdivisions 1, 2, 3, and 4, I would just delete.
Ms. Butler.
Mr. Chair and Senators, actually, you need to keep line 3.1 because it changes the subdivision number. Otherwise, you have two subdivision 1s because the on page 2.26 makes a new subdivision 1, so they need the renumbering for the current subdivision 1 that's happens on 3.1.
So you want to do the new language, right, or the restricted language?
So basically what the amendment would do would be to on page 2, require the board to include, that they must include the budget information. And then on lines 2.32, that they'd have to also publish it. And the rationale is that it should be published in a newspaper. There's still a lot of people that don't have the internet access, and at least out in greater Minnesota. And so they do look to the newspaper for their information.
Okay, on Senator Stump's motion, he moves, but I'll ask Counsel Ms. Butler to state the motion.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not exactly sure. It sounds like Senator Stump was moving just lines 1.2 and 1.3 and possibly 1.4 of the A1 amendment. I'm not certain where we left off.
Well, you could use... maybe I'm creating more difficulty than I need to. The amendment, as it is drafted, is a page in line, and so what I'm doing is reinstating the existing language in that subdivision, or in those subdivisions.
In which?
In subdivision 1A, subdivision 2, and subdivision 3 and 4.
Do you want to delete the stricken language here? Yep.
We're going to ask Counsel Senator Stump to review that. And while that's being done, I'll ask, is there anyone else?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do have another concern. And I wholeheartedly agree that the on page four, lines 4.24 to the value of there is value, I think, for us to know what the cross subsidy is in our special education programs, and I know that that is something that a lot of people look to, and I just want to, I don't have an amendment to redo that, but I think we'll be coming back to that. I think people want to know why and how much are we taking out of our general funds to pay for special education, and without that information, I think that it would be more difficult to try to. So out of that paragraph, I would like to keep the district information relating to cross subsidies in special education.
Senator Stumpf moves that at page four, line.
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't have an amendment for that right now.
But I was going to suggest one.
This bill will probably come to the finance division. So
perhaps a heads up then at line 4.30 that Senator Stumpf will reinstate the language after rate and before basic for the cross-subsidy information, whether he wants to do it now or later would be that option.
And I can, you know, we can fix up the other one, too, if that amendment seems to be confusing.
Okay, we'll hold on that. And Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, is this the report that produces the information that the department uses to determine the cross-subsidy? Or do they have other means of doing that that are standardized? Do we know that Mr. Chairman, do we know that this is the source of the information that is producing the cross-subsidy report that we receive? Is it?
If there's someone from the department.
Mr. Nauman,
or
I think.
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, given that I had a hand in drafting this one back in 98, yes, this is the source of both of those reporting requirements. The so-called set the price report is in this subparagraph as well as the cross-subsidy report. They're both there.
So, Mr. Chairman, without this requirement on the school districts, we would not be able to know accurately. There's no other data collection that would allow the department to determine the amount of cross subsidy. Maybe is Dr. Melcher, could we hear from
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. This was the original source of the cross subsidy report on special education. However, the department does calculate or does receive sufficient information from other reports to do all of the calculations, and what this language is currently driving is simply the department does all of the cross-subsidy calculations. We send it out to the school districts and ask them to do a check-off to see if they see anything wrong about that, and then they send it back to us, and we've had virtually no changes made by the school district, so we could actually continue to do the cross-subsidy calculations without this piece being required of the superintendents because they're already submitting the data that we need to do the calculations.
Senator
Mr. Chairman, I'll do one more attempt here. Let's take the amendment as it is, and Ms. Butler.
We're on the A1 amendment.
Yeah, and that pretty much gets at what I was trying to do.
Okay, Senator Stumpf moves the A1 amendment. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Prevails. Senator Carlson, do you have an additional testifier? Is there anyone else
Mr.
that would
Chair,
like?
We have a question that's come up on the bill, and it's really something that I think it might be some technical wording is incorrect here. Yes. Under line 1.9, section 1, Minnesota statutes, section 123A.05, subdivision 2 is amended. Okay, and then you go to the repealer.
Here's what we ought to have.
repealer, this would be on page 6, section 9. It says 123A.05 subdivision 2 is repealed. Okay. So we're repealing.
It's a typo.
We're repealing what we just amended. I think we have a problem with
that. Yeah, we need to correct that. Senator Stumpf has pointed out that this would go to Finance Committee, back to his division, and an opportunity to correct technical errors as well as any additional testimony that might be shared. That said, if Senator Carlson, if you'd like to move Senate File 752 as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Finance.
Oh, we do have one opposing testifier.
Okay. We'll put the motion on the table. And Mr. Bartholomew, if you'd like to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota
Business. Mr. Bartholomew, a little closer to the mic, please.
I can never get that right. I'm sorry. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And if I could, Mr. Chair and members, have a page distributed just for informational purposes. And I'll work off of this. But as was mentioned, I would like to talk specifically about the repeal of the structural balance report. We generally like the idea of trying to repeal unnecessary mandates and reports for school districts. But the structural balance report, we do actually find helpful. It was passed in 2001 with two primary goals. One was to help prevent the avoidable loss of teachers, and the other was to provide the public with information on district spending decisions, and in particular, are there sufficient revenues to meet spending commitments? And just a quick comment about the public consumption of this. About a third of the districts in the state since the law was passed in 2001 have filed either none or only one structural balance report. So its availability is uneven at best. And what I've handed out is a report from a metropolitan district that had only one report filed, and that was in 2002, as you can see. And I'll just run through it real quick. The top line current revenue shows the district's budget. And you can see it going from $89 million, $88 to $87. And then what I did was you move down to settlement, salary benefits, and then all other costs. Those are basically operating expenses for the district, and I added those up at the bottom. And you can see from 2002, they go from $90 million, $92 million, and $94 million. So revenues are going down, expenses are going up, and then you also see the line just above that, total general fund balance. And you can see the fund balance going from $8 million all the way down to minus $3.9 million. So I think as a parent in this district, I would look at this and then I would look at the last question at the top half. Did this settlement cause structural imbalance? The district replied, no. And I guess I'd be a little curious about that in the sense the revenues are trending down and expenditures are trending up and the fund balance is actually ending up in the red. And Senator Bonoff, I'll follow up on your question regarding Hopkins because I don't think Hopkins filed a report until just last year, and I'd be happy to share that. So I guess I'll just to be quick, these can provide valuable information, and rather than repeal it, we'd really ask and we'll try to work with Senator Carlson and others to fix this law rather than repeal it. We think there's some things that could be done to make it better, more effective, so it could accomplish those original goals. And one of those, for example, is clarify that one-time funds, fund balances, can't be used for ongoing expenses. And again, clearly in this example, that's what was happening. They're $4 million in the hole, and there was no explanation in the narrative about how they were going to fill that hole. So with that, we support the concept of the general bill and would hope that we could work with Senator Carlson and others to try to fix this rather than repeal. We think it's valuable.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Senator Carlson's indicated he'll work with the various parties. Senator Bonhoeff raises an important historical note for the record as to why it got there. And Senator Stumpf has indicated it'll be further reviewed at the next level. Senator Carlson renews his motion. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Carlson. You have a bill up in a little bit. If you could just meet with your testifiers. We'll ask now Senator Olson, Senate File 1328. And, again, this is another one that needs to go to finance, and we support programs for new teachers, and it's the balance of the program. So thank you, and if we could ask to have the testifiers introduce themselves in a very brief statement of their support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very pleased to be here on behalf of Senate File 1328, which, as you know, is a motion or is a bill that would make permanent the induction program for new teachers and also allow the program to be expanded. It's been a very successful program, and I have witnesses here who are going to very briefly give you an indication why they're here on behalf of the bill.
Hello, I'm Debbie Ludke from the Minnesota Department of Ed, and I oversee the First Five Mentorship Program. And I just want to initially tell you that the impact of the pilot program has really been to a select number of teachers from 3 areas in the state, 2 rural areas and 1 metro area, and was 290 teachers that were involved in that. The initial results of that project did 4 things. One was that it expanded the teachers' content knowledge about in their teaching assignment area. It changed their classroom and time management. It kept good teachers in the classroom and kept them in the school district. I have 3 people that were part of the First Five Mentorship Program that will tell their personal story. They are new teachers. One is from last year's program and 2 are from this year's program. Those 3 people are Katie Goslin, who is at Partnership Academy in Richfield, Minnesota, special education teacher. The second is Rob Rand, a science teacher from Cedar Manor Intermediate School from St. Louis Park School District. And the third is Eric Vernon, ESL teacher at Pilot Knob, which is West St. Paul, Mendota Heights. We'll start first with Eric.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Eric Vernon. I am an ESL teacher at Pilot Knob Elementary School in the West St. Paul, Mendota Heights School District. It is my first year in the program, my 3rd year of teaching. And this program has really provided me with a lot of resources that have helped me in the classroom, most importantly, mentor, connection with a mentor in my district, as well as a connection to the State Department of Education and the resources available there. And most importantly, has been time to work with my mentor to help better plan my lessons and to increase my teaching.
Thank you.
My name is Katie Goslin. I am a 3rd-year special ed teacher at Partnership Academy. And the most impactful thing that this program has had on me is that being a new special ed teacher is very overwhelming. And I have had a chance to make connections with not only other new special ed teachers who are going through the same thing that I am, but also those who have been around a while, who know the ropes, and who are able to provide help and resources as we need them. So it has been really wonderful.
Thank you.
It's Rob Rand. Again, I'm a 6th grade teacher from St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Through discussion with the other colleagues in my building that have also attended or been part with this program, we feel that the most valuable piece was the amount of time that we were given together. The biggest single gift that you can give a first-year teacher is time. When you support that gift of time with an experienced teacher who can assist with the necessary processing and planning, you increase the value of that time exponentially. The time provided at the workshops, the times provided outside for observation, and the time we were allowed to choose to spend for our own best benefited all and contributed to my ability to become reflective and intentional with my teaching. Those 2 things will stay with me as long as I teach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions from the committee. Thank you for your testimonials, and we'll ask the audience, is there anyone that would like to testify on Senator Olson's proposal? If not,
Senator Jen Olson moves that Senate File 1328 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And all in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator Olson, and to the testifiers. Great job. Senator Torres Ray. Senate File 578, and we have Eric Jolly from the Minnesota Science Museum. And the committee earlier this session was at the Science Museum, as you will recall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm going to try to brief as, be as brief as I can. And I'm here presenting Senate File 578, which will ask for an appropriation for the Science Museum for the advancement of science, technology, engineering, and math in Minnesota. That's the STEM program that many of you are familiar with. And I'm very excited about this opportunity because, as many of you know, we really have a premier program in Minnesota that helps us introduce very young children into science and math. And with me, I have the director of the Science Museum, Mr. Eric Jolly, who will talk about this. And also, he will mention, he will describe the program to you and the need for funding. But I wanted to mention to you something very special, which is that this appropriation will allow the Science Museum of Minnesota to fully utilize a generous gift provided by the 3M Corporation to build a physical space for professional teacher development in Minnesota. So I'm going to pass this on to Mr. Jolly so that he can talk to you about the program and perhaps respond to some of the questions you may have.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Jolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dr. Eric Jolly, president of the Science Museum of Minnesota. Joining me today is Liesl Chapman, director of teacher professional development at the museum. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate 578 and thank Senator Torres Ray for her support in this initiative. Science education has never before been more central to the well-being of this state. And the Science Museum of Minnesota has for decades been a premier provider of teacher professional development in programming both within our own facility and across the state of Minnesota. Last year, we were visited by 148,000 students on K-12 field trips. And even more importantly, our fleet of vans went to 109,000 students at over 355 schools and 59 community centers statewide. We bring resources to teachers and do in-classroom teacher training and professional development. We believe there's nothing more important to the future of our state than to find more creative and innovative ways to support teachers. We provided teacher professional development last year to 1,500 teachers, making us one of the largest providers, if not the largest provider, of science teacher professional development in the state of Minnesota. We work in school partnerships, teaching the physical sciences for the St. Paul Conservatory for the Performing Arts, helping to staff the museum magnet school and the public school systems. And we organized for this state for the first time a professional network for district science coordinators. We believe recognizing teachers as professionals is essential. And this proposal offers us two critical programs that will come together to serve, we believe, the entire state in a way which, with 3M's endorsement, we know will be the nation's leading facility. Imagine, if you could, a center which is part salon, part professional programming, part resource center, part science, math, consultancy, and wholly centered on creating a professional space for teachers. Imagine a center where teachers can stop in after school and weekends for conversation and reflection with other teachers. Ask questions of master teachers from our own special programming staff. Review current science content with working scientists. Certain evenings will be dedicated to providing specific schools for classroom programming. Others will review strategies for helping students overcome barriers to learn. And even more, teachers will be able to leave borrowing some of the most creative materials drawn from SMM's extensive educational collection. Imagine a teacher being able to walk into the classroom with a casing of the toe bone of a T-Rex. All of this is going to happen as the Science Museum is transforming its science house and its physical structure with the help of nearly $2 million in funding from 3M into this space for teachers to learn and grow. Imagine that 3M has given us a magic school bus full of gasoline. And now imagine, if you can, this kind of programming that we've described being available to districts statewide through an expanded regional programming and extended memberships, allowing us to beef up our staff in STEM so that we can serve a larger audience, and creating, using the six regional networks of the Minnesota Initiative Foundations, creating six teams of district coordinators in math and science supported through our programs, creating partnerships with scientists in each of those districts, with the libraries that we work with in each of those districts. Already we have the support of the statewide extension education programs. Imagine being able to take that magic school bus and for simply the price of refilling the tank of gas, bringing that core structure across the state. What 3M is offering, has given us, is going to be a phenomenal resource. What we're asking for with the support of this legislation is enough resources to leverage this incredible opportunity and bring it to the state more fully and more consistently, phasing it in the next 2 years. I will ask my colleague, Liesl Chapman, to fill in where I've left out, and then we'll be very happy to take questions.
We're very excited about Science House and the opportunities that it can create for teachers here in Minnesota and greater Minnesota. One thing that I'd like to underscore in terms of what Dr. Jolly has said is that Science House, which is a freestanding building on the grounds of the museum campus, is the state's only 100% green facility. It generates all the power that it consumes on an annual basis. And our goal for the programs that operate in Science House is that they would be green programs as well, so that we are using that facility to teach about renewable energy sources, sustainable energy, and the variety of sciences and mathematical disciplines that integrate into that as a field. So these funds will enable us to put all the data for energy usage of Science House online so that kids can see what's happening there, and so that it will be a teaching laboratory. And as Dr. Jolly said, it will be chock full of classroom sets of things that teachers can take to their classrooms so that science and mathematics and engineering study is a contact sport, as opposed to something dry and involving memorizing. We're very excited about making sure that the work we do there is keyed on the Minnesota math and science standards, and in particular to identify those concepts which research has found that kids and teachers really have trouble mastering and that are key to build a rigorous sequence of learning. So our professional development will be designed around those standards. When I was with the St. Paul Public Schools, we did an analysis of the Minnesota science standards, and they're really strong. They align very well with the national standards, the 2061 standards. So we've got standards that we can really get behind. And so it's going to be a great place for us to mobilize resources toward those ends, working at the teacher level, at the school level, at the district level, and at the regional level. So we're very excited about the work.
Thank you, Ms. Chapman. Senator Saltzman.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I want to thank Dr. Jolly for your leadership on this area, because for those of us on this committee who sit on business, industry, and jobs, that's all we hear about is we are going to be able to compete in the future if we have a highly educated workforce in these areas. And so thank you for doing this and having leadership in our state and bringing the message forward. And I think having this public partnership The public-private partnership with 3M is also a commitment that our businesses see the importance of this program. So I'm very excited and pleased to have you here today.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, thank you very much for recognizing that this state should step up in partnership with business and industry's leadership over this critical area. And I appreciate that you recognize the role that the Science Museum wants to take in bringing us to that future.
Senator Rummel and Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Jolly and Ms. Chapman, I don't know which one to direct my question to. Like Senator Salzman, full support for this. Can you give us a sense of how many teachers in a given year or given setting that we can put through this program?
Dr. Jolly or Ms. Chapman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rummel, thank you. Our numbers on this will be an expansion of that which we are already doing and an increase in the quality for our teachers. We'll be serving initially the seven-county area, Duluth and St. Cloud. This captures a large number of students and those groups of students who are subject to the greatest disadvantage in the achievement gap. That will be what we're looking to do with the 3M dollars. As we scale this up with state support, we want to look at all six of the regional service areas of the foundation initiatives from the McKnight Foundation. And we don't have a number of how many will voluntarily become involved initially. I think that would be simply misleading. We will put the infrastructure together. We've put the evaluation component in here to see that we are strongly reaching greater Minnesota. And we are expecting at least all 59 of our county library associations that we're working with to be a part of this, and we've worked with them already last year. So the number of teachers is really quite large. Do you have accurate target?
Well, I would also add
Ms.
that...
Ms. Chapman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would also add that it's a question of scale. So by working with district STEM coordinators, which the Nexus program is doing, and that's funded by the Medtronic Foundation. So you really have quite a beautiful intersection of public and private support here. That by working with district coordinators and increasing their efficacy and working with their teachers, that you increase a systems capacity. So we may work with, five district coordinators from a large district. They in turn are working with, say 2,000 teachers in turn. So the question is whether you are direct work with them or work with their system to enable folks in the system to work more effectively with them. Thank you.
Senator Olson, then we're ready to vote.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm strongly supportive of the whole STEM movement, but I need just a little more clarification here on when I see the 3M initiative. And the funds are for a museum headquarters for science teachers. Do you see science as the umbrella over technology, engineering, and math? Because what I'm looking at is, I think back to our teacher licensure. I think science teachers aren't licensed to teach math necessarily. Math is kind of a separate discipline. Obviously, math plays a role in science and vice versa, but how do you bridge this this effort? Because it now looks like the Science Museum is essentially going to provide the resources just through the science teachers or for all of these fields and be the lead entity for professional development in all four of those categories?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, thank you very much for that question. Yes, we've called it Science House as the name of the building, but it's only because STEM House sounds a little peculiar to our marketing folks. And that is to say, as a scientist and a mathematician who is also a senior member of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, I do not believe in separating science, technology, engineering, and math. Okay. All four are essential literacies for the future of our young people and for the quality of our workforce. And so the additional state funding is actually going to beef up our capacity in all of those areas. But we have been and continue to be very much advocates for all four area disciplines and the use of each to illustrate the other. That is to say, science and engineering bring math back to life for students. It makes it real. It is why we've become one of the most essential places for training the faculty in the international baccalaureate programs, because there are no other statewide entities which train to hands-on learning in the way in which we do. And I also would say that we want to work with bringing together district coordinators, as we put in our language, in science and in mathematics. I have to say that I was surprised that the state did not have an existing network of curriculum coordinators by specialty disciplines. And I am delighted that the Science Museum was able to serve as the catalyst for finally giving us that capacity.
Thank you, Dr. Jolly. Ms. Chapman, Senator Torres Ray moves that Senate File 578 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Senator Dibble. Senate File 787, and that'll be followed by 1526 and 1199. The last bill on the agenda, 387, I had asked if the principals involved in that please get together. Hopefully that's happened. Senator Dibble, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and we did receive your wise counsel through your your staff that we should keep this as brief as we possibly can, so we will endeavor to do that. So don't fear the crowd that's gathered around the table. They've been so advised as well. Mr. Chair, I'll just say very briefly, and then I'll hand it over to folks who can better describe what we're hoping to accomplish. Senate File 787 seeks to establish a three-year pilot for the purpose of connecting high school students with post-secondary career and education options, taking advantage of established community partnerships. It sets forth a number of goals that would need to be accomplished through this pilot program. It also establishes an opportunity to reflect and to measure and quantify the success of this pilot, and speaks to exactly how to go about doing that. The idea, of course, is to see if that this model makes sense and is worthy of replicating. We have a small model upon which this idea is built, which we would like to expand district-wide, and then maybe take statewide. Let me also say, Mr. Chair, that we'll probably hear from other folks about this. We have some concerns around some specific language. I'm in conversation with the school counselors. I had brought this up to them a few weeks ago. And told them about my bill and asked them to provide some input, and I didn't hear anything back from them until this weekend. There are concerns, and I'm sensitive to those, and we will continue those conversations so that this works in the way that makes the most sense for our students.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, we have Catherine Jordan from Achieve Minneapolis.
Welcome, Ms. Jordan.
Thank you. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Jordan. I'm the CEO of Achieve Minneapolis, which is a local education fund and an intermediary organization supporting the Minneapolis Public Schools. And then the last 2 years, we have actually created career and college centers in eight of our high schools in Minneapolis. We've employed a staff, we've created the spaces, and we've actually done this work. So what we're here to ask for your support about is that this model has been embraced by a number of funders in the community, and my colleague Todd Klingel is here from the chamber, who will also give us some words of support. But basically what we're asking for support is to allow us to continue this model, which we've already got on the ground. It's going very well. You're going to hear direct testimony about that. And then the idea of having a consortium of research together to understand what happens to our young people after high school, what happens to them when they go on to college or to the work world. So we're concerned about documenting this. We want to be able to measure it and bring it back to you. And this handout that you've got in front of you documents the variety of things that we're trying to do with some of the charts here that show you what we're trying to do is get to a goal that every student is a productive member of society, graduated and employed, and the career and college centers are a tool in helping that to happen. I'm going to turn it to Scott. I'm sorry, to Todd. Todd, start.
It's all right.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I am Todd Klingel, president of the Minneapolis Regional Chamber of Commerce, representing about 1,300 businesses in the region. We are here to support this bill. The job of the chamber is, frankly, to grow jobs. And if you look at the statistics coming out of Deed, we're going to be hundreds of thousands of jobs of workers short. We'll have the jobs for them, but we won't have the workers for those positions come 2012, 2015. The chamber is looking at a number of ways that we're engaged in to help close that gap, but the primary one and the most compelling one is to work with today's students. And we are doing that currently with Achieve Minneapolis in Minneapolis with a program called Focus Forward, the Career and College Initiative. And I think the key from us today is for you to know that the business community is engaged, so much so that we have already raised about $500,000 for this cause and are bent on raising another million from our members to help get these students prepared and ready for either college or a career in the workforce. But as Catherine mentioned, to be productive citizens for their own right and for the benefit of Minnesota as a whole. So thank you very much. I will now pass it over to Michael.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Favor. I'm currently the principal at North Community High
School. A little closer to the mic, please. We're being televised.
Use my hallway voice, huh? I'm Mike Favor. I'm the principal at North Community High School in Minneapolis. We're excited about this program because it gives us an opportunity to really work closely with the business community to help our students transition from high school to college or to industry. And we've had a large turnout of students who are actively involved in this program, and we are excited to be a part. And I just want to make sure that we said that as well.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Arnice Roberson, and I am the Career and College Center Coordinator at North High School. And I just wanted to share a little bit with you about what has happened in my one-year term thus far in the Career and College Center. We have really worked hard to develop relationships with the counselors. I consider us a spoke in the counseling wheel that works with students and preparing them for their futures. The Career Center is a place that is full of resources and technology that is in place to help students with life planning. I also serve as an additional person to hold students accountable to the goals that they've set for themselves. So we are poised to be an additional person to say to a student, have you made a plan and are you working your plan? We also are in a position to work directly with families, helping them understand the language of college and what it means to be prepared for college, as well as helping them with their financial planning, which includes working directly with students to complete their financial aid forms, their FAFSA, and so on and so forth, understanding the materials that comes from the colleges. Just other things that we've done that have been hugely successful this year has included a successful career fair where we have not only introduced students or brought outside members of the community into the high school, but we've introduced students to various careers and given them an opportunity to see themselves in perhaps a position that they may not have before. We are also going to be introducing students to job shadow opportunities where they will be allowed to go directly into different corporations. We have a field trip coming up with Best Buy and Medtronic and a couple other companies in the community. So those are just a few of the things that we have been able to do and be successful with in our short time in the buildings.
Thank you. And I believe Ms. Allswager, did you want to testify on this? As she approaches, I believe I had heard too that does the Minneapolis Chamber have mentoring with every ninth grader in the public schools in Minneapolis?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair.
No, it's very commendable.
Thank you. We urge you to join us in that effort.
Ms. Allswager.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. I first of all, I want to thank Senator Dibble for having good goals about what he wants to do for our children to get these students into colleges and careers that are very important and that they get some guidance as they do this. But there is a reason why there's a need for this, and that is because in Minnesota, we are ranked number 50 in the country in our ratio of students to counselors. Before we go outside, we would suggest that we fix the counselor funding ratio before we go outside to bring people in. I think there's some issues about background checks and a whole number of other things, and certainly we'll be willing to talk to Senator Dibble, but I think first we should fund our regular high school programs to the point that they should be before we go on to these types of programs.
Thank you. Senator Dibble and Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Ms. Alsweger's observations and comments. I agree completely. We need to fix the high school counselor problem that we've got, and I think the high school counselors know that. I support that goal very, very strongly, and it is my goal, as I mentioned at the beginning of the testimony, to continue in some conversation with Education Minnesota and the Counselors Association so that a proposal like this works for them, works for our students. But nevertheless, even if we do solve, you know, and we do have all the counselors that we need, developing these kinds of public-private partnerships, inviting the community in to participate fully in our public schools and our public education is something we should be supporting and something trying to accomplish. So you know, I share the goal that we solve the counselor staffing issue and funding issue, but would continue. Hopefully, we could continue to pursue these kinds of. You heard from Mr. Klingel of the chamber. You know, there are people who are knocking on our doors, trying to get in as leaders in our community with their money, with their time, with their talent as well. And so, hopefully, the counselors could work within. You know, within that framework as well.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble. I really appreciate the concept of a broad support system in making these kinds of decisions. I commonly hear, and it's kind of somewhat disconcerting, but I think that you're heading in the direction that might work to resolve it. I'll just give you one example of. It was a mother telling me about her son and made the comment that he wanted to become an engineer, and the counselor suggested that he didn't have the capability of doing that and therefore should maybe look at being an auto mechanic. And his industrial arts or industrial tech, I'm not sure, it's years enough back, it might have been still called industrial arts, told him, he said, you can do it. You can become an engineer. And I said, well, what is he today? He's an engineer. And I think that there's when you look at number two on your list of things in terms of it's kind of jumped out at me, the direct school counselors, program staff, and volunteers to initiate a career educational plan for each student. I'd like you to have the student and the family as a part of that too, because rather than it looks like somebody else is creating a plan for that student, and I think that hopefully the more heads that have insights that can help guide that student, fine, but I still don't think we should try to dampen the goals or set plans that lock a person in from potential that they may exhibit that we may not even see at the high school level.
Senator Dibble.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I hear loud and clear what Senator Olson is saying, and hopefully, number two doesn't infer that we would be tracking folks or sending them into careers that wouldn't fulfill their whole potential. And there's a great deal of involvement of the family envisioned. I think that occurs in the model that exists already and would continue to occur, and maybe Catherine can. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I really appreciate your comments because we fully understand and want to make sure that the student is the center of this planning process. This is not you know, it's not us, any of us, to direct them. And I'm sorry about that. That's an unfortunate word there, and I think we're going to be modifying that. But it's really about engaging students and helping to motivate them so that they are, I mean, this is what Arnice Roberson and her team are doing at North High School, and it's happening across all of our schools, that we're trying to energize and enlighten these young people that they have a future, that they need to start working now as ninth graders or even sixth graders about thinking about that, and that they have to be the center of that process. So we're fully in agreement with you, and we'll make sure the language fits that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I haven't thought about it, but there may be just some ways of tweaking some language here that would make that clear. But thanks.
Yeah, there would be that opportunity in its next hurdle. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble. There are lots of things in this bill that I like, particularly the public-private partnership. I think any time that we can have more collaborative efforts in our communities with our public schools, that's outstanding. And I see lots of things in here that talk about increasing rigor and raising the bar and addressing student achievement. And so I really appreciate and like all of those things. I have some concerns as well, and my concerns sort of lie around, there's lots of things in this bill that I believe that many, the vast majority of our school districts would love to do and have in their school districts. This bill regrettably addresses a very few number of those school districts based on the parameters that have been outlined here. But having said that, it seems to me as I step back and look at this a little bit further, on page 2, for example, line 2.6, where we are directing school counselors and staff and volunteers to initiate some of these things. School districts, many school districts would love to be able to have these individual plans for each of their students. And I would just encourage the committee and the next finance committee to take a more global look at this, because much of this really boils down to having the funding to be able to do that, so that we have school counselors in our high schools, all of our high schools, whether or not they're located, you know, in any particular county or part of the state really shouldn't matter. So I encourage Senator Stump and his finance committee to take a look at the global intent of this outstanding piece of legislation.
Very well summarized, Senator Lynch. And I believe we're ready for a motion if you'd like to make it for Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 787 be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Recommend pass and refer to the Finance Committee, and with various issues that were noted. Senator Olson, didn't mean to cut you off there. Did you have Senator Saltzman, before we vote?
Just a brief note. In the governor's bill, I believe there is some language to develop these plans for students, and it involves parents, and I do advocate for that because I think the sooner that our young people, but I do want to talk to you about just briefly is that I am concerned about what is the school district's role in this. And as Dr. Jolly said earlier, bringing in the sort of career component, because I think we encourage our kids to take the rigorous classes and then we fail to show them where that can lead them. So that would be something that I hope we discuss if we include this in the omnibus bill, some of those pieces to support school counselors so that our school districts have a more formal role in this, as well as involving parents, as Senator Lynch talked a little bit about, I believe.
Very good concerns noted for the record. Senator Lynch renews her motion. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Dibble, and testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next, we're going to go to Senator Carlson. We're going to take about 5 minutes on this, on the issue of kindergarten. We have had a lot of testimony at our site visits, and I believe we all know, as a policy, what we support, and it's a question of funding. There may be, I think Dr. Efren is going to have a brief statement for the record, but Senator Carlson, we have a lot of background and
if for the record you'd just like to highlight a couple of salient points.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're going to go real fast. For the record, we're on, this is the all-day, every-day kindergarten bill, and it's Senate file
1220.
Yes. And what I have is I have a parent and Ms. Jan Altswager from Education Minnesota speaking. And what I want to do is I want to make sure that everyone is aware of what all-day, every-day kindergarten is. We used to have it. We backed away from it. And it is one of the things that we, probably one of the best things we can do to get rid of the gap. So with that, I'm going to introduce Mr. Chuck Heard, I'm sorry, Mr. Steve Whedon, President and CEO. Actually, you're an employee of MRI. Is that correct? And he is a parent in the Burnsville school system and has had some children that have gone through all day.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Whedon. I'm not affiliated with the school district or an educational. I am the chief executive officer of a medical device company in Burnsville and a parent of three kids. And the reason why I'm talking today is I have no children who are coming up through kindergarten anymore. I have three kids who are in elementary school, a sixth grader, a fourth grader, and a first grader. So I have nothing at stake personally for all-day kindergarten. However, I do have some experience with all-day kindergarten. My sixth grader did not have all-day everyday kindergarten available to her, but my fourth grader and my first grader both did. We paid for that service, but it's something we were very pleased to do. And also, and I'll stay very brief, I apologize. As I've helped out in schools and volunteered my time in all three of these kids' classrooms, I've not only seen the effects of all-day, everyday kindergarten for my own children, but also for their classmates. And I can tell you there's lots of things that folks will say about all-day kindergarten that is scary. It scares parents. We don't want to let our babies go to school yet. They're not ready. They're too young. They're too small. It was a decision my wife and I struggled over for my fourth grader. She was very young. She's a July birthday and very, very small little thing, very shy. And what we found was that all-day, everyday kindergarten not only helped her academically, but also socially. And it was something that these children acclimate to very quickly. It takes just a matter of weeks. And these kids that parents were sure were going to fall asleep in the middle of class or not be able to stay focused for a full day certainly do stay focused for the full day, and the teachers make that possible. My oldest daughter is very outgoing and got all of our attention, of course, because she was our only for several years. We were very proud of the fact that she could read by the time she was done with kindergarten because she was sort of alone in that situation. But we're finding that's not the case for Riley or Robbie, my younger two, and we're very pleased with the education that not only they got but their classmates got as well. Last thing I'll say is that this is not a thing that fades by third grade. With the challenges that our schools have and the class size increases that we've been forced to deal with over the past several years, despite 34 kids in my fourth graders class, they're all doing much better than their my older daughter's sixth grade class was doing at that time. They're better at math, they're better at reading, and those effects are lasting. Last thing to say about this is that the things that you can accomplish in all the everyday kindergarten on top of reading and math are the things that make math stick, and Dr. Jolly mentioned it earlier. The fact that you get science involved in math and a reason for kids to like math, those are the things that you have time to do all day, every day in kindergarten. Thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing your testimony. Ms. Altswager.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Altswager, Education Minnesota. I'm going to briefly just state some bullet points. I know that you are in a hurry to complete your work. Teachers rave about the successes that they make with children. Those who have taught half-day kindergarten and moved to all-day kindergarten rave about the successes that these kids have. There's more continuity in the program for the children. Teachers don't have 40 kids to deal with, or possibly more. They have now 20 kids. You have more communication with parents. You can better meet the needs of the individual student. The CFL, formerly the Department of Education was known as the Department of Children, Families, and Learning. They did a study in 1996-97 approximately, and their conclusions were that this improved student achievement. And then I'm going to give you one interesting thought that I had never thought about myself. Someone told me, who is an expert at economics, said that funding all-day kindergarten can be one of the most significant things that you do in improving the economy in Minnesota. Why is that? Single moms who have a child at home for half of the day and the other half they're in school, once you take that mother who is in poverty take that child and put it in the child into all day everyday kindergarten, you now are creating an opportunity for this single mom to work in a full-time job, thus having an impact on other aids that you might pay that family. I just thought that was an interesting thought. And certainly we'll probably need more study, but an economist made that point to me. So and last of all, I would say that parents really like it. In school districts where they have some limited space, they'll have lotteries, and they have long, long waiting lists because they want their child to have that opportunity.
Mr. Chairman.
And I'd be happy to answer any questions later on.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Altswiger, I just wanted to clarify something. You said that teachers had 40. Are you saying that they have 40 students in a class, or are you referring to if they teach two sections of half day that it's 20 per section?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I was referring to if a half-day program had 20 kids in a program,
okay,
that they'd have 40. But in some kindergarten classes, there are more than 20 at this point.
Thank you. Dr. Ephraim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here from EdWatch, and I will just say that the same comments I make today will apply to the all-day kindergarten bill that is up on Wednesday, so I won't testify again. We have concerns about all-day kindergarten that is based on not anecdotes and not emotion, but on very large, well-conducted studies, the largest of its kind being the longitudinal study of 22,000 kindergartners by the National Center for Education Statistics, which found that it's called the Early Childhood Longitudinal Study, and it said in part, quote, in terms of kindergarten program type, there is little meaningful difference in the level of children's end-of-year reading and mathematics knowledge. That's at the end of a full-day kindergarten program. They did find some difference, but statistically it was not meaningful in for the amount of time that the child spends and the cost. One has to look at whether that is worth it. They then said, quote, this report did not detect any substantive difference in the child's third grade achievement relative to the type of kindergarten program, i.e. full day versus half day they attended. And finally, third grade reading, mathematics, and science achievement did not differ substantively by children's sex or kindergarten program type. That's that study. The RAND Corporation, which is a big proponent of early childhood in general, found in their evaluation of longitudinal kindergarten data that attendance in a full-day kindergarten program had little effect on reading achievement, but was actually negatively associated with mathematics achievement and development of non-academic school readiness skills by the fifth grade. Those non-academic school readiness skills that they found in children in full-day kindergarten found lower levels of disposition toward learning, lower self-control, worse interpersonal skills than children in part-day programs. Children in full-day programs also showed a greater tendency to engage in externalizing and internalizing problem behaviors than did children in part-day programs. And they also found, the RAND Corporation found, that home background variables were the most important for these non-academic behavioral type socio-emotional issues, and we need to promote parents having time with their children, which means not funding every program under the sun that is raising taxes and forcing more and more mothers into the workforce. And the last thing I would say is that the National Center for Education Statistics has also found through a lot of data that 94% of our children are proficient at recognizing numbers, shapes, and counting to 10 at kindergarten entry. 92% are eager to learn, 97% are in good health, and 82% have basic pre-literacy skills, such as knowing that print is read from left to right. So there probably isn't the crisis in kindergarten readiness that is being portrayed.
Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address the committee? Senator Carlson, would you like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 1220 be recommended to pass and go forwarded to Finance. Is that correct?
Yes. Discussion? Senator Lynch.
Chair Wieger, Senator Carlson, my only comment is that as this moves forward, as the discussion on kindergarten, whether it's voluntary or not, there are districts that may choose to elect to go forward with something like this or may like to go forward with a program such as this, but they have some structural constraints. They may not have the room in their district or in their building, and I just encourage members to keep that in mind as this dialogue continues so that we can afford all districts an opportunity to do what they feel is best for kids.
Good point. Space is an issue. On Senator Carlson's motion, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The remaining four bills will be as follows. Senate File 1199, 1526, 387, and the Policy Bill 1246. Senator Rummel, and if Professor Roberts could come up to the stand. Madam Chair, committee members, Senate File 1199 addresses student services aid. Earlier in testimony, you heard about the need for counselors as well as the need for other support staff as a part of the student service team. A coalition of groups has worked on Senate File 1199. You've asked for them over the past sessions to come up with a solution, and this is what is presented. I call on Professor Walter Roberts, and he'll give a quick overview, and Ralph Mays and others are here to offer a brief statement of support.
Welcome, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Walter Roberts, Jr. I'm a professor of counselor education at Minnesota State University, Mankato. I appreciate this opportunity to share information with you, and yes, I promise to be brief. Student support services do just what the name implies, support students in ways not addressed in the regular classroom. These services come in the form of academic, personal, and social counseling, special education case management, chemical dependency counseling, nursing and other physical health-related responses, crisis intervention, and conflict resolution. Minnesota has neglected in many ways the provision of student support services to the children and families of our state. If we truly intend to leave no child behind, then we must acknowledge that the fact that children are more than the sum of their test scores. Their lives are not confined to the classroom. They bring into our schools a wide diversity of home and family experiences, economic opportunity, and problem-solving abilities. Personal social issues among youth are linked to academic failure, increased absenteeism, higher dropout rates, difficulty in finding and keeping jobs, and the greater likelihood of entanglement in the criminal justice system. Let me briefly illustrate how student support services respond to the emotional needs of today's children. Nationally, school counselors, school psychologists, school social workers, school-based chemical dependency counselors, and school nurses report spending between 32 to 52% of their time responding to some type of mental health issue impacting the academic progress of children and adolescents. Student support personnel in a six-month period between January and June of 2005 provided 44% of some type of services to non-institutionalized children and adolescents with emotional and behavioral issues inside our schools. The top six most frequently listed behaviors impacting the academic progress of K-12 students include adjustment issues related to interpersonal and family stressors, aggression and bullying, behavioral disruptions, adjustment issues, anxiety, and depression. Excuse me. Nearly 50% of the schools reported that a common factor preventing the families of students with personal issues from receiving assistance they need is the inadequacy of student personnel services. In a state that takes tremendous pride in educational quality, there is evidence of cracks in the mental and physical foundations of our children's well-being. Trends from the 1992 to 2004 Minnesota Student Survey of students in grades 6, 9, and 12 revealed that more reported frequent behaviors indicative of depression, showed no marked decrease in reported feelings of discouragement or hopelessness, two of the most prevalent precursors to suicidal behaviors. Thus, it's not surprising that they maintained high levels of suicidal thoughts, somewhere between 15 and 21% at any given time, or that they showed no significant reduction in suicide attempts. The students also reported increasing concern over parental chemical usage, which negatively disrupted their lives. Student services personnel serve as an early warning and screening mechanism for the mental and physical health care communities of our state. It is imperative to remember that student service personnel are the front lines of early intervention and referral for children and adolescents who may need additional and more intensive mental and physical health care. It is clear that there is never a shortage of children and adolescents in need, but there is a shortage of qualified student services personnel needed to respond. In Minnesota, access to student services personnel is inconsistent at best, non-existent at worst. As you know, the state ranks next to dead last, and depending upon which set of figures one wants to determine, we may be dead last in the provision of school counseling services to K-12 students. Likewise, it was recently reported that the number of school nurses in Minnesota fall below recommended federal standards needed to provide proper access to school-related health care. Schools simply do not provide consistent, comprehensive student personnel services. Many cannot afford one or more of the student service professions, thus leaving gaps in critical service provision to students and families in need. This is not a problem for schools of one particular demographic type over another. It's just as prevalent in rural schools as it is urban. This condition is unacceptable to the children and families of this state. Senator Wiegers' legislation is a critical step in addressing this neglect and oversight. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Mr. Maves.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Ralph Maves, and I'm representing the Minnesota School Psychologists Association here today. I am a retired school psychologist, and I will be even briefer than Dr. Roberts. We speak often of leaving no child or no student behind, of having higher academic standards, of having more course rigor, of preparing all students to be able to compete in a global economy. For a number of students, this is a relatively easy road to travel. For others, it's not, for a variety of reasons. These other students may well need the support of student support services personnel at times along the route from kindergarten to graduation to be successful. It may be the help of a school nurse, a school social worker, a school counselor, school psychologist, school chemical health worker. Oftentimes, it's the support of two or more of these professions working together, along with teachers, administrators, parents, and the students themselves. As Commissioner of Education Alice Segrin said on public radio today when discussing educational issues, as students are moving through the system, we need to have supports for them all along the way. I could not agree more. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maves.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Lombardi. I am a licensed school social worker in St. Paul, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota School Social Workers Association, or MISWA. And just to be very brief, here today, just to let all the members know that MISWA is very much in support of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Lombardi. Are there any questions for the panel?
That completes our testimony, Madam Chair, and the coalition has worked together for several months. It's been a great deal of heartache as they lose in their members and budget cuts across Minnesota. We know the importance of the classroom teacher, but they're a part of the student delivery of services, and the numbers are very clear. It's a disturbing trend, and it's an issue that needs to be resolved in finance as to whether we're willing to fund a commitment, but this is what the organizations have put together, and it's supported by thousands and thousands of their members.
Senator Wieger, we certainly saw that demonstrated for us when we visited Senator Torrey's Ray School, how important this component was. Senator Bonham.
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, thank you very much for bringing it forward, and thank you to all of you because it is a critical need in all of our schools, and every single school we represent speak to us about it.
Thank you. Other comments? Senator Wieger, would you like to make a motion?
Yes, I would move that Senate File 1199 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance Committee.
Further discussion? Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
Aye.
Bill moves.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair, and Senate File 1526 addresses school counselors and supervision of non-licensed individuals, and Walter Roberts, again, is here to address that.
Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Walter Roberts, Jr., and I'm testifying today in my role as a professor of counselor education at Minnesota State in Mankato. Senator Wieger today is introducing a bill to ensure that no student in Minnesota public schools receive inadequate counsel from non-licensed individuals who provide academic or post-secondary advising to K-12 students. The bill is designed to protect students from receiving substandard guidance or misinformation from individuals who purport to be knowledgeable about many important aspects which come into play in the decision-making process related to how adolescents and their families make post-secondary decisions. The career and post-secondary choices that adolescents make are very complicated. It's not just simply about getting a kid into college, but rather ensuring that each child and family receive the information based on the entirety of that child's educational background and experiences so that the family and child can, in turn, make the best fit decision about the future, be that future a four-year, two-year vocational or trade-type post-secondary institution. Senator Wieger's bill creates a supervision process by those individuals in schools who are most knowledgeable and educated in the field of academic and post-secondary counseling, the licensed school counselor. It creates a mechanism to ensure that if outside advisors are utilized in a school, their work will be monitored for quality, accuracy, and that it meets school district objectives. Furthermore, it protects student confidentiality by ensuring that the Minnesota Data Privacy Act and the Federal Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act are fully followed. It is important to note that the bill acknowledges the fact that those who deal closely with students in the post-secondary decision-making process often encounter students with emotional issues requiring additional assistance. The proposal adds another layer of protection for students by also ensuring that non-licensed individuals are in direct contact with supervising school counselors who have the education and expertise to respond in the event of such emergencies. I've included for the committee in the packet that you have from Minnesota State Mankato, a fact sheet from the State of College Admission 2006 report by the National Association of College Admission Counseling, which I believe better illustrates the multifaceted factors impacting the post-secondary decision-making process. In a related matter, I'm sure that the committee has also seen the Minnesota Measures report from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. It's my opinion that one of the major elements that will increase successful high school transition and retention at the post-secondary world is for every child to have access to a fully licensed and degree school counselor at caseloads which, at the very minimum, meet national or regional averages. Thank you very much for this opportunity once again to testify before the committee.
Thank you once again, Mr. Roberts. Yes, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Roberts, when you refer to non-licensed individual, are you referring to non-licensed in school counseling or that they're non-licensed for any particular role in the school district?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, it would be non-licensed in any particular role serving in that capacity.
So Mr. Chairman, this does not put a licensed counselor over any other licensed personnel teaching in it. It's only non-licensed
Madam Chair.
For any role. Okay.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, you are correct.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Senator Uyghur, would you like
Madam
to?
Chair, I'm not sure if there's opposition. Would yield if anyone wanted to weigh in at this point.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Schneider with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I did not have the privy to hear the answer to the non-licensed, because that was one of our concerns about this issue, is about non-licensed personnel. Were we talking about non-licensed guidance counselors, or are we talking about other non-licensed personnel?
Mr. Roberts?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm not exactly sure the specifics of your question. The answer that I gave Senator Olson was that those and school counselors would be supervising and helping those individuals in non-licensed capacities if a school chose to use those individuals.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question. Yeah.
Mr. Schneiderman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that's one thing that we would be concerned about, and we understand the value and the importance of guidance counselors around the state, and we understand the importance of having academic standards and teachers to teach to those standards. But one of the issues is that we're afraid that this may limit some of our flexibility at the local level in terms of hiring people and making sure that we have people who are to advise those students in the post-secondary. And I'm also concerned about the fact that does this specific to middle schools, high schools, or would this be specific to a district? And so and I'm also a third issue is the written permission requirement that would be required. I believe there's a legitimate educational interest standard that may be required by districts. So if you have a legitimate educational interest, you could certainly review the student's file, and this piece asks for a written permission, which may delay the piece. So we understand the issue here. We're absolutely sympathetic to the need for guidance counselors and their value to school districts, but I think this piece may be a little bit limiting for local school boards. And so we hope you take those concerns under advisement and be open for questions.
Are there additional questions or comments? Senator Uyghur, would you want to make a motion or?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I certainly would be very willing to work with others as this may progress in the process and sit down. They know I would commit to that. But the bottom line, again, every session we talk about the fact of all the cuts that are going across the state and dead last counselors and other support staff. And maybe there is a flexibility concern here, but look at the figures. I would move that Senate file 1526 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance Committee.
Further discussion by the committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Passes.
Madam Chair, I know the time is flying, but on Senate File 387, I would ask if the parties reached an agreement then that there be a brief statement on the record, and we'll entertain a motion, and then it's my understanding on the Department of Education's policy bill, a couple of provisions that may have been controversial are being deleted, and we'll get to that very shortly. So this Senate File 387 is an initiative from the Board of School Administrators, and we'll ask for one comment of support and others available for questions.
So, whatever Chair Uyghur, members of the committee, Ram Singh, Legislative Chair and member of the Minnesota Board of School Administrators. We are very happy to be here this evening to speak in support of Senate File 387. And we want to thank you for considering our request for an extension of the rulemaking authority. We did meet with Mr. Orenson about his matter, and we mutually agreed that there is no need for an amendment at this time. If we are given the extension, we'll have enough time to address the issues raised to the satisfaction of all. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I would like to introduce Dr. Bruce Kramer, member of the board, and Dr. Jean Haar, another member of the board who will speak. I would like to recognize on my left our executive director of the board, Dr. Judith Lamp. Bruce.
Welcome, Dr. Kramer.
Madam Chair,
I'd just like to give the committee a little bit of history. We were granted expedited rule writing authority in 2005 in order to clean up technical language that had never been taken care of since the inception of the board in 2000. Things like the fact that we have a Department of Education now, not a CFL, and we don't answer to the commissioner like we did before that time. The rules that were changed in 1997 were actually quite a large rule change in the state of Minnesota. We went from seat time, basically, to a competency-based licensure in the state. And we've been working with that rule now for 10 years. But the rules that we have are old. The rules for principals, for example, were developed in the 1980s, long before the issues such as school safety and security, the issues of technology, and other issues that have come with federal and state legislation came about. And we find that the rules are that they are in need of updating. There are areas in the rules that we are currently trying to work with. We've been working since 2005 with a committee of about 20 members representing four different professional groups: the secondary school principals, the elementary school principals, the state special education group, and also the community education directors, because all four of those areas are represented in our licensure purview. And we've done quite a bit of work in the last 2 years, but we find ourselves, as we look at the rule writing process, and particularly at some troubling areas within the rule, where we just need more time. And so what we're asking for is we're asking for a one-year extension. And I'll turn the microphone over to my colleague, Dr. Haar, and she can outline a little bit more what we have done, just to let you know that we do work.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, we know you're working. We had an earlier discussion about the board and confirmation hearings, and this is non-controversial. It's an extension of 1 year, and I'd like to move that Senate File 387 be recommended to pass and referred to finance.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Any discussion on the motion? Those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The rule does.
Yep. And, Madam Chair, next is the policy bill from the department. Chaz Anderson and support are here. We want to give you the overview. It's been given to each of you by email as well, with a summary and their availability. A couple of controversial sections will be deleted, and I'll now go to Chaz Anderson.
Welcome, Commissioner Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chaz Anderson. I'm the Deputy Education Commissioner. If you'd like, we can start with Article 1 and Dr. Melcher, or we could take up the amendments that we have in order.
It's up to you.
Okay, well, let's take the amendments first. The first two amendments actually come from the St. Paul School District. This is A1 amendment.
Move the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment has been, a motion for A1 amendment has been made. Those
Authors
in favor?
Amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, is this just an author's amendment to put it in the shape, or is this
yes.
something that we should actually have and see before we vote on it?
No, they're supported by the department, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, and their author's amendments.
But we will know what they are here?
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Olson and committee, A1 amendment basically does as follows. It's just to provide districts with flexibility to offer appropriate programs in a cost-efficient manner. This is permissive language. What it would do is allow a district to apply for a waiver from the racial imbalance requirement of the desegregation rules. This comes from St. Paul in particular because they have a significant ELL program where when they bring in the new immigrants, they bring them into one program at first, and this would put them not in compliance with the desegregation rule. So this would allow for those exceptions, and it's permissive language. It does also keep intact the requirement that the districts give parents a choice, that the student could attend another school, but would allow that those programmings to continue that they found to be successful. The A2 amendment.
I would renew my.
The A1 amendment has been moved. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Madam Chair, I'd move the A2 amendment to be explained by.
Chess?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the A2 amendment just clarifies existing practice that the district has the option of transporting children to an intensive learning center throughout the grade served. It's purely technical. It's basically what happens in practice, and the St. Paul School District requested this language.
A motion has been made for the A2 amendment. Those in favor?
Aye.
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 Madam Chair, the third Madam amendment Chair, I'm going to offer as a
excuse me, Commissioner.
You didn't get opposition, and I think you need to rule on both of those amendments, that they passed or failed.
Oh, I'm sorry. Both amendments have passed. Thank you.
Madam Chair, a final would be an oral amendment, and we'll have Chaz Anderson also move, and she will give us the wording.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the oral amendment would begin on page 25, section 8. We would propose deleting that entire section. That proposal was related to our maltreatment of minors program involving private and confidential data during an investigation. In discussions with stakeholders, there was the need for further discussion on this amendment, and also the need for the Judiciary Committee to first consider this proposal. So we are going to delete this and forward a proposal or bill to the Judiciary Committee for consideration.
So the oral amendment is to delete the entire Section 8?
Section 8, yes.
On what page, Madam Chair?
Page 25 and 6.
Yep. Starting on page 25, it would go all the way to page 27. It would delete the entire section.
So the amendment has been moved. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment passes.
Madam Chair, Dr. Melcher is going to present Article 1.
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that last amendment, what you were trying to do is to what the language in the bill did was keep certain data confidential. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, under current law, under the Maltreatment of Minors program, the data is treated as private. And what we were attempting to do during an investigation, an open investigation, is treat that information as confidential rather than private. What we were running into is that as private data, the only person who can receive that data under the Data Practices Act would be the subject of the investigation. And what is happening is that we work hand-in-hand with law enforcement, particularly when it's a criminal violation or potential criminal violation, and the law enforcement investigation is confidential. Our investigation, which is working with the law enforcement, so, for instance, we will interview victims and witnesses together rather than interview them twice, is private. And what was happening is that the subject of the investigation is obtaining all of the witnesses' statements, the statements from the victims, before they are allowing themselves to be interviewed by the law enforcement and by the department. And so this is creating a situation where investigations being conducted by the department and law enforcement are being undermined by the subject of the investigation because they are able to obtain the statements and interviews from victims and witnesses. Mm-hmm. So in the need of wanting this to go to the Judiciary Committee to be considered first, we're deleting this, and we will move forward with a separate bill.
Okay. Madam Chair, as you move forward with that bill, there's several instances where bullies have been creating an incident in schools, and that, because they're both minors, the information for the person who is the victim is made public and ends up in the paper. But the information for the perpetrator is either confidential,
yeah,
or somehow protected, so that the individual who's causing the trouble is protected, and the individual victim ends up being their name gets put into the paper. So as you take that legislation to the Judiciary Committee, try to see if you can fix that. Either make it all one way or all the other.
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, we do not release information on victims or witnesses. We're not allowed to under the State Data Practices Act. So I'm not sure why that is being released by another entity. But we will certainly take up that issue. And if you can give me examples of what's happened that'd be helpful as well.
I will. I'll give you, you know, personal examples.
Thank you, Senator Stumpf. Dr. Melcher.
Members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I'll walk through Article 1 very quickly. Article 1, Section 1 is a technical cross-reference correction dealing with the property tax shift. Article 1, Section 2 deletes obsolete language and also would include the referendum tax-based replacement aid in the definition of general education aid, thereby eliminating the need to have a separate appropriation for tax-based replacement aid separate from the rest of general ed aid. Has no impact on dollars going to districts. Article 1, Section 3 is clarifying what happens if a cooperative does not maintain effort for special education. It simply says that if one of the members of the district has caused the cooperative to not maintain effort, then the penalty is assessed against that particular school district. Article 1, Section 4 is another technical amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you. Dr. Melcher, is this a change for our state? In the past, if a school district has failed to meet maintenance of effort, has the state been responsible?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, the current provision is that the school district is responsible for basically refunding the dollars in order to pay back the federal government. However, the current statute is not clear what happens if a cooperative fails to maintain effort. Earlier, there was discussion about whether it would be more appropriate for all of the members of the cooperative to pay equally or whether the individual member which caused the co-op to be out of compliance should be the one that's assessed the penalty. And the department current interpretation is that it should be directed to the school district which created the problem in the first place rather than having kind of the innocent members of the co-op having to pay the bill. And this would clarify that in statute.
Thank you.
Dr. Melcher.
So Section 4 is a technical correction of a cross-reference dealing with the property tax shift again. Section 5 is a technical change dealing with the referendum market value tax levies as they relate to abatements. And Section 6 and 7 are relating to the repeal of an obsolete section of law dealing with a grandfather provision for school districts that were enrolled in a non-resident district in the 70s, and it no longer applies to any school districts.
Took a long time to find that.
Madam Chair, Article 2, starting with Section 1, the change in Paragraph A is adding charter schools and non-public schools and transferring education records. This is consistent with what's required under federal law, and we just wanted to clarify that practice that exists. Paragraph B is a situation where a charter school closes. We've had a few of them close over the last few years. There, in one case, there was a dispute over who should receive the education or student records. They end up going to the department, and we would like to clarify that actually those records should go to the resident district of that student rather than the Department of Education because we don't actually serve students. Paragraph C is related to transmitting reports when students' educational records transfer. What it does, it wasn't as clear as it should have been, and so what we did is add language that any formal suspension, expulsion, and exclusion would be transferred to with the student records if they transfer schools, and that they would have to comply with the FERPA Act, which is the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, and provide a notice to parents when that transfer occurs. Madam Chair, Section 2 of the bill, as you may know, in 2005, the legislature added a categorical aid program for the gifted and talented programming. We are adding paragraph C, which is consistent with other categorical programs, that school districts adopt policies and procedures around programming for gifted and talented education. And so this would add that section to that program. I will say, I know the chair, Senator Uyghur's asked to be brief. The two witnesses that have come up, they're from the gifted education programs. They wanted to testify in support of that provision. They're available if after the testimony if you'd like to hear more from them.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Section 3 of the bill pertains to changes to the statewide testing and reporting system. This was something we have gone over in the Finance Committee. What this would do is clarify the graduation test for students that it is in grade 10 or grade 9 for writing, grade 10 for reading, grade 11 for mathematics. And they would, in order to graduate, they would need to either A, obtain a passing score on the grad test, which is a subset of questions embedded into the MCA 2 high school test, or they could achieve that through a proficiency score on the MCA 2 test. So there's two ways that students could meet that requirement. There's some additional language if you go on page 8 that clarifies that onto page 8. For instance, in paragraph E, we're adding language that the school level that we provide technically sound accommodations for and alternative assessments is consistent with federal law for special education students. If you look at number 3, adding language that the general statewide test should be appropriate for the students rather than saying language of incapable of taking test. And of course, that is all decided by a student's individual education plan. Number 3, we're making changes. We don't actually publish student scores of the ACT. We publish state results. That would actually be a violation if we actually published their scores. If you go to paragraph C, we are striking that provision that districts must report exemptions under paragraph D, clause 1, which is special education. Actually, we already have that information through the testing process when they report data to us and to the testing company. So having another requirement that they report it to us again is redundant, so we're recommending eliminating that provision. If you go down farther, there's some language in subdivision 1A, paragraph D, again adding that the accommodations for alternate assessments need to be technically sound accommodations. Going on page 10.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stumpf.
On 9.24, when you're deleting a value-added component, what explanation is there?
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, I'm going to have our testing director come up, but there's a lot of, we're doing a lot of work on the difference between growth and value-added. They're two different measurements, and I'm going to have Dr. Manson testify to that.
Welcome, Dr. Matson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dirk Matson. I'm the Director of Research and Assessment for the Department of Education. Although it looks different, it is simply a technical clarification that value-added, growth and value-added, as we've explained in some of our recent work, as the Deputy Commissioner said, are actually two different things. Value-added, there is a full and complete statute requiring us to do value-added, and we just wanted to clarify that by the end of this current school year, we will not have value added in place, but plan on doing so in the very near future. And that statute covers that other statute.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, continuing on page 10, subdivision 3, the requirement requires 3 performance baselines. Actually, what we report is achievement levels on the MCA, so we're just technically making that change to show what actually was done. And then on subdivision 4, access to tests, just a technical change. It says students' actual answer sheet, we say actual responses. That's more relevant than the answer sheet. Madam Chair, Section 4 of the bill, this actually section was added into law in 2004. The federal government has a process, which is generally known as the House process, that allows a teacher who is not meeting the highly qualified provisions to go through an alternative process to become highly qualified. When this statute was put into place, the federal government had not finalized regulations in this area, and so in order to expedite the process for getting teachers through this process, because the Board of Teaching had not put that in place as yet, the legislature put a statute in place that outlined what that House process would look like. Since then, the federal government has revised its regulations and restricted the use of what's known as the House process for teachers. And so what this language does is complies with that federal requirement and that they meet certain minimum competencies, which is actually reflected in our state licensure laws. Madam Chair, going to the next change, we would be going into page 12. This is on lines 12.33. We've actually discussed that today and in previous committees. This is elimination of the, what's known as the superintendent's report on passage rates in the BST. We are recommending eliminating this requirement. I know there was discussion about the cross-subsidy report. We would be happy to continue that report. We don't need this report, particular report, to report on the cross-subsidy. It's, again, a duplicate effort. So we would be supportive of any report that would require us to do a public report of the cross-subsidy.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Anderson, is it required that we put in statute a requirement for the department to report the cross-subsidy to us, or is that with the removal of – obviously, it was clear from the last discussion that you generate the information rather than the districts. The districts essentially affirm it or confirm that data. But do we need to direct you to prepare that report for us?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, if that's something the legislature would like us to do on a date certain, it's probably best to put that in statute and direct us to do that. But it's something we report on quite regularly. It's a commonly asked question. We, for instance, every year at the superintendent's conference, Dr. Melcher reports on that to the stakeholders. And so it's something we have published many times in different formats. But I would leave it up to the committee to decide whether or not they want to mandate it or just allow us to proceed as we normally do.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, going to the next provision, this is on page 13, section 7. We're striking language regarding charter schools. Just to refresh the memory of the committee, in 2005, the legislature removed the department's authority to sponsor any additional charter schools. This is just cleanup language from that, because what this says is that the applicant, if a sponsor decides not to sponsor an applicant for a charter school, that they could go to the department for sponsorship, but there's another law that says we can't sponsor any charters, so this just clarifies that we are not sponsoring charter schools. Also, there's a second provision there that says that we, if they couldn't find a sponsor, that we could help them find a sponsor, and simply we do not have the time or expertise to help charter schools find sponsors. That's their job, and that's what the charter school board should be doing. Madam Chair, the next provision is on page 15, section 8. Current law actually lays out the conflict of interest in charter schools for that's related to lease aid costs and renting lease. And what we are attempting to do here is take this, the conflict of interest language, and place it throughout the charter school law. It seems that we should have, if this conflict of interest applies to one section and not others, it's uneven application of that law, and we think it would be best suited if it were throughout the charter school law rather than just one particular program of the charter schools. It's also many of these provisions are also required under the federal startup aid program. So there's many different federal requirements that match these conflict of interest requirements, and it just makes it clear for everything what the conflict of interest is for charter school boards and sponsors. Madam Chair, the next section is on page 16, section 9. Again, this is just clarifying something we talked about as well. When a charter school closes, the education records for the student is returned to the district of residence. So that's very clear who should be the recipients of those student records. Page 17.
Madam Chair, section 10 on page 16, line 24 is clarifying which version of Avondale membership is used to calculate a career and technical levy. It's clarifying you would be using the Avondale membership served by a school district as opposed to the resident count. That's most closely aligned with the need for the vocational funding. Section 11 on page 17 is the heading called cross-reference correction.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
Mr. Melcher, is there quite a difference between what the current levy is and the new version?
Madam Chair and Senator Stump, the language that you have in front of you, the existing language, is a revised version of the career and technical levy that was enacted, I think it was last year or the year before, to take effect this coming fall. We've been basing the career and technical levy on a frozen database from fiscal year 2001.
starting with the next levy, they certify to current year information. And we just noticed that in drafting the legislative change that occurred a year or so ago, that we forgot to specify which version of average daily membership. And since we do have both the resident count and the served count, we wanted to clarify that was the served count that would be used. And that's consistent with what we do in most programs where we're basing the funding on the number of students served. And we thought that that would reflect more closely the number of students that would need to receive career technical services as opposed to the resident.
Madam Chair, Mr. Melcher, do you know what we based it on when we originally set that levy?
Madam Chair and Senator Stump, we were assuming it would be the served count, but we didn't have it clear in law, and we have not actually calculated this levy yet. It will be calculated for the first time next fall. Right now, we're just basing it on the amount of career and technical aid that the school district received in 2001. I think it's a minimum of $10,000 for the amount of aid they received in 2001. So we don't really have any historical precedent for implementing a new formula next year and wanting to have it clear.
Madam Chair, moving to Section 12 on page 17. We're proposing changes to the American Indian Scholarship Program. This is a program that provides scholarships for higher education for American Indians, and a recent legislative audit report in this program suggested that the department establish procedures for distribution of the scholarships based on recommendations from post-secondary institutions. If you go to page 18, what we're recommending is that we work with post-secondary and that after application of federal Pell Grant money and state grant money and other scholarships, that they be awarded then their scholarships through this program. And this would be dependent on the student's unmet needs after that point. I will say at the last sentence that we're proposing that scholarships are available for for 5 years of undergraduate studies and 5 years for graduate level. There is a technical correction I'd like to make on line 18.17. After 5 years, it should say at instead of and. This is just a minor typo. And then students may acquire only one degree per level and one terminal degree, which is considered the highest degree possible you can earn, such as a PhD or a doctorate degree.
Madam Chair, I'd move those suggestions.
The motion has been made. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, Section 13 is just a reviser's instruction on the bill. Section 14 is a repealer that eliminates the commissioner's ability to grant exemptions for ELL licensure. As you may recall, the Board of Teaching has recommended that change. Generally, first, the Board of Teaching is the one that should be issuing the licenses or not issuing waivers and exemptions and not the commissioner. And second, they feel that this is an appropriate elimination of a mandate and have made this recommendation to the committee and the department.
Regarding the calculation of special education tuition bills for non-resident students, lines 19.16 through 19.18 are clarifying that it's the referendum equalization aid that is included in the calculation. There is a substantive change in this section on page 20, lines 11 and 12, which would be adding care and treatment sites approved by the commissioner to the list of programs that are allowed to apply for a waiver from the system. These sites quite often have very high costs for general education programs, and it was felt that we need more flexibility to ensure that they could bill appropriately for special education programs. Section 2 of Article 3 is changing the language as it currently relates to summer programs for special education to extended school year programs to conform to federal regulations as it relates to these programs. That's terminology used in the federal regulations. It clarifies that the funding is only available for extended school year programs that are in the student's IEP, and then the students with disability wouldn't necessarily qualify for summer school funding related
to the IEP.
Section 3 is clarifying that community-based services for children with a disability are included in the travel aid. Currently, the statute specifies only the home-based program, but the program since the 90s has also included services provided at community-based sites such as Head Start programs, early childhood education programs, other child care programs. So it's not just when the staff are going to the student's home, but also when they're going to places where the student is receiving child care during the day. This travel aid is provided, and that reflects the current practice, but the law needs to be clarified to include that. The Section 4 is also dealing with the extended school year, and it's striking a reference which historically required us to calculate or collect separate data for the regular school year versus summer school. We currently have a fiscal year application for special education, which reflects the entire fiscal year, including summer school. Section 5 of Article 3 is clarifying the calculation of the general education revenue that is used in the calculation of contracted services aid. What has happened over the years is that the definition of general education revenue has changed, and the definition used for calculating contracted services aid has not kept pace with that. And so we're out of sync, and this would move the calculation back into sync. This would also exclude the alternative teacher compensation revenue from the calculation, consistent with what we do in other areas where we did not want to penalize districts that had received that funding in terms of their special education need. Section 6 is making the same adjustment with regard to the out-of-state tuition, updating the language relating to general education revenue, and again excluding the alternative teacher compensation revenue that the school district would be using. Section 7, again, is a technical clarification relating to the terminology used for referendum equalization aid as it relates to the special education tuition bill.
Madam Chair?
I'm sorry, Senator Olsen.
Section 8.
I have a question for going back to page 22. On, let's see, 22.16, where it says 68% of the salary of each essential person. I mean, is that's the whole the problem we're having with special ed, isn't it? That we're not, the state's not paying our portion. Is that what it's relating to right there?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, this is current language as it relates to special education funding, and this piece of the statute is calculating the base revenue, which is 68% of the second prior year salary. However, by the time we apply the statewide funding cap, the school districts are not actually receiving the full 68%. They're receiving something less than that. And that was the discussion that the committee had the other evening as it related to the cap on special education.
Okay.
Other questions? Dr. Melcher?
Madam Chair, remember Section 8 of this article was
deleted in the amendment.
And Section 9 is repealing a section dealing with interagency services.
That's
125A10 and 125A75-6 is deleting the requirement for school districts to do a separate application for summer school as opposed to the regular school year courses. Unnecessary provisions. Moving to Article 4 of the bill, Article 4, Section 1 would put a 10-year limit on the capital project referendum levy. That would be consistent with the 10-year limit we have on the operating referendum levy. We currently do not have any school districts in the state that have a capital project referendum levy that lasts more than 10 years. We think it's appropriate for the voters to review those at least once every 10 years. School districts have difficulty projecting what their facilities needs will be more than 10 years into the future at any rate. So this would just make that consistent with the 10-year limit on the operating referendum
levy.
Article 5 of the bill, Section 1, is eliminating the obsolete reserve accounts. This is similar to one of the bills that you heard earlier, but it's narrow, more narrowly focused, only eliminating those reserve accounts that are actually obsolete, that are no longer having any new revenue brought into them.
Madam Chair, Article 6 of the bill, Section 1, just clarifies existing practice. The department is responsible for the Minnesota Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped under a cooperative agreement. This is current practice, and we're just putting this in law so it's clear who's responsible.
Madam Chair, Article 7.
For the record, would you identify?
Karen Carlson with the Department of Education. Line 29.28 is a technical amendment, and also line 30.6 is that didn't get caught last year. And Section B is a change in how Head Start, the current practice in Head Start allocates funds to programs up to a certain level of expenditure without taking into account the number of children served. And we're changing policy here to pay upon children served. And this is consistent with the children served is consistent with the federal intent and the federal language. The department and the Head Start Association worked on this language over the summer, and also this language is similar to new language in the federal Head Start reauthorization bill. Section 2 and Section 3 relates to requirements for full-day services, and there's been a lot of promotion from the federal government with Head Start to form partnerships with child care services or establish full-day services of their own because so many kids need to be taken care of outside of the narrow Head Start day. And so actually the feds published some data, and the national average is 47% of Head Start programs having full-day services, and Minnesota's percentage is only 14%. And so this is an attempt, this language is an attempt to do a phase-in policy and to increase that percentage in Minnesota to make it more consistent with the national average. The Head Start Association, actually, we were working with the language today even, and we're going to continue to work with this language a little bit over the coming week to provide some additional clarification, but the intent will remain the same.
Madam Chair and members,
this been passed down.
Yeah.
Seven. Section 4 is the definition for full-day kindergarten, which is defining full-day kindergarten as an academic program that prepares students to enter first grade. It's provided for a minimum of 850 hours in a school year, which is 5 hours a day for 170 days. And which includes curriculum and instruction, which are along with academic standards. Also specifies that learning activities provided through community education are not considered full-day kindergarten. This is related to Section 5 and 6 of the bill, which would allow school districts to charge a fee for the unreimbursed cost of full-day kindergarten if the district have that as an optional program and also half-day kindergarten programs. There has been quite a bit of uncertainty out in the school districts in terms of full-day kindergarten. Can you charge a fee or can you not charge a fee? And many school districts are, in fact, charging a fee, but they're running it through the community education fund in order to avoid some concerns that it may not be legal to charge a fee in the general fund. So this would just kind of try to set the matter straight and say, we're defining full-day kindergarten, we're saying that a school district can charge a fee for full-day kindergarten if they have a sliding fee scale that ensures that no one is not able to participate in the program because of poverty. We think this is a way just to clarify things for the school district. Section 6 is also related to this and is basically amending the prohibited fee by clarifying that there's an exception here.
Madam Chair and members, Section 7 permits school boards to enter into agreements to provide education under a unified administrative structure that would align standards, instruction, curriculum, and assessment from pre-K, kindergarten, and grades 1, 2, and 3 so that can all be provided together. And Section 8 is a repeal of the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation language, and members will recall that that was established last year as a partnership governed by a board of directors composed of private and public members. And during the summer of 2006, the foundation decided that it could best accomplish its mission by vesting itself in a private board, and so therefore the law is not needed anymore.
Dr. Melcher.
Article 8. Section 1 is dealing with adult basic education. The stricken language is
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, excuse me.
Senator Bonham.
So is that MELF's intent to be private then?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, yes. Actually, they wrote up something that said they could best accomplish their mission by keeping the governance of the organization vested in a private board rather than pursue a public-private governance partnership.
Madam Chair, I understood that it was public and private in partnership and that we were funding it and that was a condition of the funding. Is there an issue with that?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, they actually returned the $1 million of public funding to the department. Who returned it to the general fund?
Okay.
Dr. Melcher.
Article 8, Section 1 is dealing with adult basic education funding. The stricken language is obsolete. New language on page 35, lines 16 through 19, with the increasing the limit for an individual program from 8% to 11% per year. Last year, the legislature enacted a change in adult basic education funding, which provided a 3% increase in the amount of funding available. At that time, it was thought that pretty much all of the programs would be receiving a 3% increase. But inadvertently, what happened, because there was a cap on the growth rate, some of the more rapidly growing programs, they were not getting any increase as a result of the increase in 3% in the total pie because they were capped. So what this does is add 3% onto the existing growth rate. They had been capped at an 8% rate, so that basically all school districts or all programs participating in the program would benefit by that 3% increase, and it wouldn't be excluded from that.
Madam Chair, Section 2 relates to the GED test fees. This does not change the overall appropriation for that program. We are just moving the amount that can be reimbursed for an eligible individual from $20 to $40. This is in hopes that we utilize the full $125,000 appropriation in the program. Currently, we do not utilize it all, and we think it's because we have capped it at $20. So we're proposing to move that reimbursement to $40.
And Madam Chair, Section 3 is the repealer as repealing an obsolete provision dealing with fiscal 2001.
That was a whirlwind effort. Yeah.
Madam Chair, that completes our presentation. Several amendments have been made. I appreciate the reps from the gifted and talented being here in support, and there's others that could also provide support. But if there is anyone in the audience that wanted to testify against, we could get that on the record. And keeping in mind that this does need to go to Senator Stump's committee where it would have further scrutiny.
Senator Wiegert, I understand Ms. Kolitar is willing to stay afterwards for anyone who wishes to talk to her, and her testimony is on the table. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Dr. Ephraim.
Chairwoman. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of EdWatch, and I am going to comment just on Article 7, the early childhood provisions. Starting on, well, my major concern is on page 34, but the article starts on 29. We appreciate the department's efforts on the on clarifying the funding for Head Start, that it's for children that are actually in there, and for repealing MELF, which was an unaccountable public-private partnership, and they didn't want to be accountable to the public, so it was good that that is being repealed. But our major concerns are in the on page 34, starting at 34.4 through 34.25, with regard to aligning preschool through grade 3 curriculum standards, assessments, et cetera. First of all, for the purposes of demonstrating efficacy, given that there is so much information about the lack of long-term efficacy of these early childhood programs, which I've testified to on numerous occasions before and will not repeat now, we question it from that standpoint. We also question aligning standards when the early childhood indicators of progress, which are the grade 3 through or the grade age 3 through 5 standards, have never really been scrutinized and have many concerns related about vagueness, subjectivity, controversial content. And when the legislature went through a very long, protracted, multi-year struggle with the profile of learning, and these standards essentially are bringing up the same controversy and problems that was involved with that, we don't think that there should be an alignment of standards without much more thorough vetting and discussion. Regarding the kindergarten readiness assessment, that is also full of very vague, subjective issues that are dealing not only with subjectivity in math and reading, but also areas in the social and emotional development, which are even more controversial. And I have a copy of that for the members' scrutiny. And I have one copy of the summary of all 100-plus early childhood standards, which can be copied and distributed at the committee's pleasure, just to give you an idea of the kinds of issues that are being dealt with. Even in testimony in the House about the kindergarten readiness assessment, the teacher that was training other teachers to do that admitted concerns about validity and reliability. So to with the stroke of a pen, align pre-K through grade 3 when there is this much question about all of those issues is an enormous concern, and I really, really, really caution the legislature to not get into that. No.
Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. Senator Stump.
Senator Wicker.
Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 1246 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to Finance Committee.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The bill passes.
Yeah, that concludes our business.
That concludes our business for the evening. It's been a long evening, and we wish to thank everyone who has come out to testify today. With that, we adjourn.
Good job. Good job. I've got to get some. Good job.
Hmm?
Oh, nice. Okay. Nuances, and yeah.